Why is it that you sneer every time you refer to this country? You've done pretty well here. I don't get it.
No, you wouldn't. You're one of the ardent believers, a good American. Oh, there are millions like you. People that plod along without asking questions. I hate to use the word stupid, but it seems to be the only one that applies. The great masses, the moron millions. Well, there are a few of us who are unwilling to just troop along. A few of us who are clever enough to see that there's much more to be done than just live small, complacent lives. A few of us in America who desire a more profitable type of government. When you think about it, Mr. Kane, the competence of totalitarian nations is much higher than ours. They get things done.
Yeah. They get things done. They bomb cities, sink ships, torture and murder so you and your friends can eat off of gold plate. It's a great philosophy.
I neither intend to be bombed nor sunk, Mr. Kane. That's why I'm leaving now. And if things don't go right for you, if we should win, then I'll come back. Perhaps I can get what I want then. Power.
It's Friday, it's 5 o'clock, and welcome to the Glastonbury edition, or not the Glastonbury edition, of Not the BCFM Politics Show, on Friday the 24th of June 2020, streaming live from the People's Republic of Stokes Croft Arts Centre in Bristol, and at radioqUK.com in Camberley, Surrey, with our new live stream address, which is talkradio.org.uk. I'm Tony Gosling. Thank you for turning off the psycho in the corner, gaslighting us with its military-grade Ukraine psyops and the COVID medical misinformation. Actually, increasingly, some decent information. We'll be hearing some of that tonight. An estimated 60,000 Brits died because they didn't get the basic ivermectin treatment for COVID. The London media lies, have these all now been forgotten? And the transmitter and printing press owners, bent on turning society into a hostile environment for readers, many of them anyway, listeners and viewers, and particularly for gypsies. London's souring gas waffle media trying to herd tens of millions into the Zuckerberg metaverse. Instead, navigating us through the Fourth Reich Matrix, the World Economic Forum's Fourth Industrial Revolution, and the ultimate collapse of the world economy, maybe, is Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. This week, my new investigation into the English Civil War, looking at it as a much longer battle for control of the British Crown by merchants and occultists hell-bent on providing the Industrial Revolution with lots of willing workers, privatising the countryside at the same time in enclosure and creating a British Empire which they wanted to use to try to take over the world. And in part two, we got three parts tonight, the by-elections just announced this morning, a usual look at why Bristol media are boycotting Mayor Marvin Rees. Well, this is a news story yesterday right across the journalistic world. Bristol media, BBC, ITV, the Bristol Post, Bristol 24/7 leading the way of boycotting the Mayor Marvin Rees's press conferences, and also looking at the rail strikes and what the former Corbynista and Labour MP Chris Williamson makes of if he was Rishi Sunak, why he has got what he has got so terminally wrong in the Treasury, and also the dangers of the online safety bill, plus Chief of the General Staff saying the British military must prepare to fight the Russians in Europe. Really? And in part three, we discuss the end of the world, nigh or otherwise, with Bath-based author of the book End Times Again? And writer for the Catholic Weekly The Tablet, Martin Wittock. So, Iranian and Russian news cancelled, first by the telecoms cartel, then by Ofcom 2 back in February-March 2022, earlier this year, and also cancelled off Bristol Community FM by the Bristol Mafia, but not cancelled here. So, yes, stay clear of the PRSC radio page, because unbeknownst to us, the people who run the People's Republic of Stokes Croft website just took us off there and put a load of other stuff on, which I'm afraid is a little bit like what happened to us over at BCFM, stuff that you're not actually finding out very much at all. But the new stream address is talkradio.org.uk. That's one word, talkradio.org.uk will take you straight to our live stream every week. So good idea to bookmark that or do something to, because if anyone is going to the, try and pick this show up via the People's Republic of Stokes Croft, that's the prsc.org.uk/radio site, I'm afraid you won't be getting anywhere. Anyway, so starting this week with this new article that I've put together, it's called Enclosure for Empire. And it's looking at really the main part of the article is a timeline, really looking right the way back from the time of, well, 1118, with the founding of the Templars after the First Crusade, right the way through to the years after the English Civil War, and to things like the Glorious Revolution in 1688, the William of Orange lands at Torbay with 14,000 soldiers. But anyway, I'm going to try and run through it reasonably chronologically. And Martin, if you want to chip in, correct me on various factual errors, and I can make a little note and double check it, and then maybe even proofread the article a little bit, change the article, sub it. So it's really look the subtitle of the article is The Bankrupt Brewer of Huntingdon and Solomon's Temple, an untold story of the English Civil War. Now, the bankrupt brewer of Huntingdon refers to who, Martin?
I presume you're talking about Oliver Cromwell.
Oliver Cromwell, that's right. Well, what I'm trying to do, I suppose, here is show that he wasn't really anything special, although there's lots of people on the left that seem to think Cromwell was some sort of hero for killing the king. There's all sorts of other aspects to the Civil War, which mean, I mean, for example, the way that Cromwell massacred the Levellers at Levellers Day when we went back in May this year down to Burford in Oxfordshire, where the Levellers Day is organised. Lots of the lefties there were sort of backing Cromwell, even though it was Cromwell that ordered the three heroic martyrs from the Levellers outside Burford Church to be shot for mutiny because they wouldn't go to Ireland and fight the Irish for him. But they still somehow make out that you know, Cromwell was some sort of hero. Anyway, so this is really a look at the origins of the 1642 to 1649 English Civil War, many of which have been established by historians and university departments over the centuries. Central to their tenets are the grievances over Charles's arbitrary rule and the three monopolies of church, printing and trade. So the idea that the church was very strictly and rigorously controlled and everybody had to go to church, but it was all completely controlled from the top down by the new Church of England. Then we also have printing. Also, anyone that wanted to print anything had to get it first licensed first. And so what happened was printing presses were liberated, and some pamphlets, etc., back in the Civil War, many of them were printed on these so-called illegal presses. Printing was another monopoly they hated. And trade, often called ship money, where the king was said to be putting on too many taxes onto trade. He was doing this, of course, because he'd fallen out with Parliament and he needed to raise some money.
Ship money,
that's right.
Ship money was actually money that had always been ship money in the ports to pay for the Royal Navy. But ship money was extended to the inland areas, which they'd never previously paid.
Well, hang on, the ships can't go inland.
No, that's why the inland areas said, hang on a minute, this is a non-traditional tax on us, because the ship money was a traditional... You know, it's traditionally allowed for the king to levy ship money in ports, but right. he then extended it inland because he was doing it without Parliament's approval, and of course that then led to John Hampden's rebellion, who was eventually imprisoned and so on. So it wasn't the ship money thing; was about the funding of the navy,
right? So I mean, you could even go back to the Norman invasion 1066. And look at the tensions between the new Norman rulers and the previous Saxon rulers. But we're not really going to do that tonight. Of course, when they imposed the Doomsday Book, which was named after the Day of Judgment, I mean, people said this is the Day of Doom, and they were sending a warning to us today saying this Doomsday Book's terrible, where they went around taking an inventory of all the land. There were riots around the country, you know, back before then. So the whole issue of the land, which is one of my main tenets in the article, is I think, absolutely at the heart of what was going on in the English Civil War. So one of the most important things about the Civil War, Martin, and I think you can definitely comment on this, is in the 1960s and the 1970s, there were people like Brailsford and Christopher Hill writing about the Civil War in a way, elucidating stuff from original pamphlets from the time, doing their own research after the Second World War that had really never done before.
Yeah, I mean, previously, I think S.P. Gardner was regarded as the sort of Whig historian of the era, but Christopher Hill, who was Master of Balliol, he was a communist, basically. He was in the Communist Party, and there was he very much pushed the idea that the English Civil War was a bourgeois revolution to create a capitalist society, and he saw it as analogous with the French Revolution or the American Revolution. It's still a very influential analysis, and of course Brailsford and others talk to Rawls about the levellers.
But what about Marx? Because he also said quite a lot about this whole agrarian problem, you know, the idea that suddenly people had no land of their own, they couldn't grow their own food, they had to go and work in factories. Marx is very big on this.
Yes, but you've got to remember, when you say that they were, that the enclosure was the removal of people's right to the use of the land. The land never belonged to them. The land always belonged to the landlord classes. So the idea that there was some kind of peasant utopia before enclosure is wrong.
Well, okay, these people were serfs. I think they weren't. Serfs.
Mostly they were.
They had a very important thing, that is security of tenure. So they couldn't be evicted.
No, they didn't. I mean, this is one
of
the things.
They had a thing called copyhold back in those days, where their kids would always
copyholders were not necessarily the majority of the peasantry. Yeah. So there's always, I mean, the ownership of the land was always very highly concentrated, but the rules around use of the land were allowed usufruct to people who were born in the parish.
For example, the Earl couldn't sell the land. I mean, because they had all these sitting tenants everywhere.
What they could do is that one Earl gets his head chopped off for treason, and another Earl takes over that piece of land according to what the Crown decides.
That's right. But the
people just get shunted from one to the other. They never got a say in any of it.
No, that's absolutely right. But there was a big change during enclosure. Anyway, so we go back to my little timeline. It also looks at the fact that you've got the witchcraft trials going on after the Reformation. So if we start, though, with the Vatican founding the Knights Templar after the First Crusade in 1118, then we look at the big split that went on between the Catholic Church and the Orthodox Church in 1154, not long after. But then within around about 90 or 100 years of the Templars being founded, then there was suddenly this massive battle between Orthodox Constantinople and on Rome, with the sacking of Constantinople. So it was almost as if this whole idea of the Templars was a complete ruse by Rome to charge in the direction of the Orthodox Church. And effectively, they ended up destroying Constantinople. That didn't destroy the Orthodox Church, but it wasn't a very friendly or Christian thing for them to do. Then in 1312, the Templar Order was extinguished by the Vatican. 1348, we saw, and this is one of the things that's prompted me to do this week, is the founding of this Order of the Garter. So that was, I think I said 50 years last week, but it's actually more like 25 years after the Templars were extinguished in 1312. But apparently, one of the things I was reading is that there was never an order extinguishing the Templars by the Scottish King in Scotland. So it could well be that the Templars went from their main port in La Rochelle, just sailed up to Edinburgh. And especially if they'd had word of what the French king was up to. So we'd have the founding of the Order of the Garter in 1348 in Woodstock in Oxfordshire with 26 knights. The legend is the motto, "Shame on anyone who thinks this is evil," originated when the Countess of Salisbury, dancing with the king, dropped her garter and he gallantly picked it up. However, in her 1921 anthropological study of witchcraft, Margaret Murray says the garter is a hidden emblem of a witchcraft high priestess, indicating control of a coven of 13, and that the king may have simply been demonstrating his support for her. Then in 1381, we had the Peasants' Revolt. After that, which is believed to have been orchestrated by the Underground Templars. Now, a lot of this stuff is in, and the links between Freemasonry and the Templars are in John Robinson's book, which I cite at the end. It's called Born in Blood, Lost Secrets of Freemasonry, published in 1989. So the Peasants' Revolt, a lot of the Templar property, which had been handed over to the Knights Hospitaller, was confiscated. and they and also or destroyed, burnt down, that sort of thing happened during the Peasants' Revolt. They threatened the Templars, threatened the boy king Richard II, using the peasants, and also they were regaining and destroying property they'd lost previously. So then also after that, 1446, Roslyn Chapel was built in Midlothian, southwest of the ex-Templar port Edinburgh, by Sir William St. Clair. Then we had between the 1450s and the 1480s was the Wars of the Roses, these dynastic battles over 30 years, tied up with England losing control of its then French territories. The sides symbolised by the white Lancastrian and the red Yorkshire five-pointed roses. And after the Battle of Bosworth at the end of it in 1487, England settled down a bit. There'd been all these bands of brigands around all over the place, and things started to get a bit calmer. I mean, obviously, this is medieval times. It's not totally calm. Then we started to have loads of the a series of depopulation acts put down. This one is under Henry VII. Against the pulling down of towns, because this whole idea of enclosure was starting to gain track. The idea of basically just evicting peasants from their cottages and using the stones from those cottages to build your own place, maybe a manor house or whatever, but then turning all that land over to sheep. So this is the whole idea of privatisation of land, of enclosure. And this 1489 was the first act of Parliament, and the king, signed off by the king, to try and put a stop to this, so they could see lots of people were being made homeless. Then we had 1492 and 97, the so-called discovery of South America and the Caribbean by Columbus, and North America by John Cabot, sailing out of Bristol here. Now, I do say here there's evidence that these places have already been discovered, and this really was just a way to prepare the public for what was to be centuries of colonisation from Europe. Then we've got more depopulation acts in the early 1500s, royal anti-enclosure commissions in 15, 16, 18 and 19. So lots being done to try and address this issue. But then there was a recognition after a while that the people who were being asked to stop enclosures were the people who were benefiting from the enclosures. So a lot of these acts of Parliament were getting absolutely nowhere. 1534, an act to try to stop sheep farming, the Sheep Farming Restraining Act, things like that, more depopulation acts. But then we come across the Reformation. Between 1536 and 1541, you had the dissolution of the monasteries by Cromwell's great-grandfather. Well, Oliver Cromwell's great-grandfather. And Henry VIII's chief minister, Thomas Cromwell. So that's 900 religious businesses and institutions are nationalised and sold off. 12,000 in religious orders are sacked. And the debt the Crown owes to these monastic institutions, with tens of billions of pounds in 2022 currency, is all cancelled. Well, that's handy, isn't it? Henry VIII hasn't got to pay anything to these monasteries. The Reformation is beginning in earnest, really, with an attack on the commercial operation of the church. In fact, the destruction of it, because they had been a very important part of the commerce of the nation. The church had been doing these things. They were doing education, libraries, hospitals, this sort of thing, via these various monastic institutions, all then taken over by the Crown. So then in 1542, because of the kicking out of the Vatican by Henry VIII, they passed England's first Capital Witchcraft Act, removing jurisdiction from the church courts to the crown courts and assizes to prosecute witchcraft. And of course, so various these witch trials started. And also in the 1500s, 1549, there was a thing called Kett's Rebellion in Norfolk over enclosure. East Anglia was ruled for 7 weeks from under an oak tree by Robert Kett and 16,000 peasants. The enclosures were locked up. That's the people who'd been evicting the peasants, were all locked up in Norwich Jail for stealing the land. And King Edward the Sixth's army is twice turned back by the rebels, but then reinforced and finally defeats them. So that's in Norfolk in 1549. So we've got more depopulation acts, more and more. This is all in the, as you can see, in the build-up to the Civil War. There's a battle going on here over whether or not you can privatise land and kick all the peasants off to go and work cheaply, and so that they're dependent on you, basically, more and more dependent on you, slaves, your slaves. Depopulation Act in 1563 repeals all the previous Depopulation Acts as ineffective. And as I say, they're realising that, well, there's no point in passing this law, these laws, because the people who are going to actually bring the laws into effect are benefiting personally from enclosure. Pointless. And then in 1563, there's a Post-Reformation Witchcraft Act passed in Scotland, which makes witchcraft or consulting with witches a capital crime. Now, these acts to do with witchcraft are coming in because of the Reformation, because the Vatican is no longer around. And people perceive that, you know, this is something that the church, sort of that the state has to deal with, that the church has not dealt with. Elizabeth I's Witchcraft Act is in 1563. She very sensibly reduces the penalties for witchcraft because, you know, we don't really want witch hunts, just chasing after people without proper evidence. Except it remains a capital offence only for those proven to have also caused harm. So you can't just say, oh, I saw such and such with the devil. They've also got to have been proved to have caused harm. And if they have, then that's a proven case. So Elizabeth I reined back the initial witch hunts of Henry VIII. Then in one of the most interesting aspects of all of this is in 1577, John Dee, who was Elizabeth I's advisor, privately published something called the Vision for, it was a vision for the ascendancy of a projected British Empire, advised by Christopher Hatton and Robert Dudley. For Elizabeth I's general and rare, the book's title is A General and Rare Memorial pertaining to the perfect art of navigation. Through part of Dee's plan, Elizabeth claims privateers Francis Drake, Walter Raleigh and John Hawkins are not working for the Crown, but actually, of course, they are. The idea is here that, you know, Dee's idea really is that if Britain can really be vicious and on the seas, on the high seas with the Royal Navy and various other third parties and other hidden actors, that Britain can then start up having an empire and beat the Spanish, you know, the French, the Dutch, the other European powers who are starting to build up empires. And for further information on that, there's some excellent articles at the National Maritime Museum in Greenwich by the deputy curator Alex Grover. So then you've got from 1581 to 1795, there's something called the Dutch Republic, where Catholics are persecuted. It's to play a major role in providing finance and military expertise to Cromwell during the forthcoming wars. Then you've got 1590, you've got the North Berwick witch trials, and these are all, by the way, tried by juries. And I just get slightly frustrated when people like Nicola Sturgeon start saying, oh, there was nothing to see here. It's actually a jury trial, so perhaps there was, and it's not really a politician's job to say that the jury were all wrong in one of these trials. About 100 people were accused, and many were exonerated, but some weren't. And one of them, who wasn't exonerated, was Francis Stuart, the 5th Earl of Bothwell. And other gentry were also accused at North Berwick, which, by the way, is not that far from Roslyn Chapel. 1593, more Depopulation Acts. 1597, James the 7th, the 6th of Scotland, publishes something called Demonology, purporting to enable the identification of witches. So a lot of this is tied in with witchcraft, Martin. Just to bring you in here, the idea here is that this was something... is there anything to see here at all? Do you think that there was any witchcraft going on, or is this just complete fantasy?
Well,
by the church, you know, sort of propaganda.
Well, in academic historical circles, there's a bit of a debate about this. So people like Ronald Hutton, who was at Bristol University, I think he still is at Bristol University, he tends to take the view that there was no such thing as witchcraft, but it was actually, he's interested in paganism and so on, but he doesn't see a very strong pagan influence in witchcraft, where Carlo Ginzburg, who's an Italian academic, sees witchcraft across Europe as being the remnants of paganism from before Christianization. And I think, you know, the evidence can be construed either way. I mean, folk beliefs in rural areas were very varied, and some of them went back a very long way, and some of them were relatively recent, and you can't necessarily generalize. I think the thing about European historians is they like grand theories. whereas in British historical circles, they pretend to stick to evidence and let's not have any grand theories here. It's just a series of, you know, things that happened.
Well, I quite like grand theories too, but I do like to try and evidence them, which is what I've been trying to do here. So we've also got during this period, you've got the joining of Scotland and England. So James I of Scotland published his Demonology, which says, this will help you identify witches, well, and demons. So, I mean, whether he's right or not is a whole other question. But
it's very influential.
But, yeah.
If the king has written a book about how to seek out witches, then you can imagine everybody's going around looking for witches.
Yeah, well, including Matthew Hopkins a little bit later. But anyway, 1603, 24th of March, James I ascends to the throne of England, whilst having been James VI of Scotland for 36 years already, uniting these two monarchies. In 1604, James I passes a stricter witchcraft act, that is, overthrowing Elizabeth I's lenient act, and it's enforced by self-styled witchfinder general Matthew Hopkins. So around about this time, I find it so fascinating this stuff's all going on concurrently. Between 1604 and 1607, there are enormous anti-enclosure revolts in Northamptonshire, Bedfordshire, Buckinghamshire, Huntingdonshire, Leicestershire, Lincolnshire, Warwickshire, culminating in 1607 in an armed revolt under a leader with the pseudonym Captain Pouch. 40 or 50 rebels out of a ragtag army of about 1,000 peasants are shot dead at Newton by a body of mounted gentlemen with their servants, while several others are hanged and quartered. I mean, this isn't going through trials at all. This is just execution by the rich on their horses with their guns, of the anti-enclosure rioters. And 1605, during the anti-enclosure riots, is the gunpowder plot orchestrated by Lord Salisbury to test James I out and also to justify further persecution of Catholics. Then the governments in 1607 to 36, the governments of James I and Charles I set themselves against John Dee's covert empire building by pursuing an active anti-enclosure policy. So this is in the first four decades or so of the 17th century. Charles I and James I both decide, no, we've got to stop enclosure. We must stop it. And they work obviously, you know, separately because they're both individuals, but they both had the same object. Now, this all is also at the same time going on here is the 1611 publication of the King James Authorized Version of the Bible, commissioned in 1604 and recognized still as one of the most accurate translations of the Bible. So this is the first time that this authorized version has ever been available. There had been some previous Bibles, but this one was printed and distributed all over the country, so people could, for the first time, ordinary people, if they could read, could pick up and read it for themselves and say, hang on a minute, they've been saying this, look what the Bible says about that. Then 1612, the year after that, you had the Pendle witch trials up in Lancashire, culminating in 9 hangings for maleficium, causing injury by divination, and some self-confessed coven members. That was they were actually hanged on the 20th of August. Now, this, remember, was under the more strict King James Witchcraft Act rather than the one that we have to prove that people have done harm. So then in 1625, Charles I ascends to the throne. We then have the 1629, 11 years tyranny. Charles rules without Parliament. So as you can see, all this is, you know, the enclosure, the witch trials are all really the setting for this, the Civil War. And just before the Civil War breaks out, 3 royal anti-enclosure commissions levy high fines on those who have been enclosing land in contravention of the Depopulation Acts. Charles I levies a total in 1600s money of £50,000. Now around about that would be in 2022 would be around about 2.2 billion fines levied on these landowners who've been enclosing. Well, I wonder if we had that sort of those sort of fines on big landowners today, Martin.
Well, the fact is that the landowners were stronger than anybody's attempt to prevent them doing what they wanted to do. I mean, in Thomas More's book Utopia, which came out in 1519. There was, you know, he was criticising landowners for getting rid of people and replacing them with sheep, It was an ongoing, I mean, the modernisation, if you like, of the British economy was ongoing. And of course, the wool of produced by the sheep was the basis of national prosperity. So you can see this is a very strong vested interest. And they took over all the monastery lands and all the rest of it. But of course, this is, you know, the primitive accumulation that Marx talks about in Das Kapital, which leads to the possibility of a capitalist takeoff and an industrial revolution.
So we're running forward towards the beginning of the Civil War now, and the 4th of January 1642, King Charles attempts to arrest the five members, John Pym, John Hampden, Arthur Haselrig, and Denzil Hollis, and William Strode. We now know they were already safely hidden in the City of London, which may have been tipped off by a spy at court. Charles had first gone to the House of Lords demanding they arrest the MPs for him. After a short debate, the Lords refused, and so Charles and his accompanying guard of soldiers had to go into the Commons themselves to make the arrests. Charles utters the opening line of the English Civil War, "All the birds are flown," and humiliated, he leaves London. So he goes off to Oxford, and Charles raises his standard at Nottingham in August 1642, hoping the loyal aristocracy will support him against Parliament.
Can I just make the point that Charles I had to recall Parliament, because as you know, for many years he'd ruled without Parliament, but because of the rebellion in Scotland against the prayer book by the Presbyterians who were dominant in Scottish politics, they were actually working quite closely with the Earl of Warwick and the Puritans in the English Parliament, and therefore, in order to fight the Scots, and don't forget that the Stuart dynasty originated in Scotland, they needed an English army to go north to fight the Scots. And in order to find an English army, they then had to call Parliament. And of course, when the English army was defeated by the Scots, then the Parliament demanded changes to the constitution to give more power to Parliament. And this is when the Civil War is tipped, the English Civil War is tipped into action. But of course, it's not just about England, it's also about Scotland, and it's also about Ireland.
So, I mean, a lot of looks at the Civil War dwell on the actual battles. I'm not going to do that, but some of them were very important. The 2nd of July 1644, Battle of Marston Moor near York. Prince Rupert for the King took on Cromwell and Fairfax with Edward Manchester in command. Confusion reigned on both sides, but Manchester grabbed the initiative, routing the Royalist army, inflicting crippling losses. So this was one of the first major indications of the way the war was going in 1644. In February 1645, money, which proved to be decisive, is spent over the winter refashioning the parliamentary army for what proved to be a decisive 1645 fighting season. This is the Parliament's new model army of 20,000 soldiers, much better equipped, disciplined and trained. This new model army, Martin, it's often talked in about the English Civil War. It does seem that at this stage in the war, it was decisive. Things were a little bit in the balance, 1644 and 45, but this kind of was the clincher.
That's true. And the new model army, of course, was the core of the Burford rebels, which were then crushed by Cromwell later on. And it was, you know, it was modelled on when the English Civil War, or whatever you want to call it, the War of the Three Kingdoms is what they call it in the history books today.
Well, I don't think they do. Some people do. They call it the War of the Three Kingdoms.
Well, no, you can call it whatever you like, but academic historians call it the War of the Three Kingdoms. Well, the reason being that the war started in Scotland in the way I just explained.
It did start in Scotland. It started with the battle between Charles and Parliament, and that was
But that was because he'd had to recall Parliament.
Just an attempt to revise history. To confuse people. No, it's not, Tony.
All the time, we constantly reinterpret the past in terms of current debate.
But this battle between Parliament and King in London was at the heart of it.
Yes,
not
but
Scotland.
Also
these were peripheral places where this battle was being.
It's a bit like saying
Ukraine, as you know, is all about Ukraine. It's not. It's about much bigger powers.
That's right.
It?
So it's not just about England.
Right. So
it's not about Scotland and Ireland.
Well, that's right. And it's a continuation of things that have been going on in Syria, etc.
Well,
so
yes, the focus, a continuation of the 30 years war, which was in Germany, which is a struggle between Protestants and Catholics.
The focus is the struggle of power.
bigger than power. Much bigger than the English Civil War.
The focus is the struggle of power between the King and Parliament, basically, and the City of London, but Parliament represented. Battle of
Naseby. That's the narrow focus.
Naseby in 16. Well, no, it's the heart of it. 14th of June 1645, Battle of Naseby. The New Model Army does reasonably well, captured though, leaving. Yeah, so Charles's forces in the Midlands are decimated there. I mean, the writing's on the wall here. Then you get to 1645 with the Leveller pamphleteer John Lilburn, who's a former officer working for Cromwell in the New Model Army, was arrested. So there's people writing pamphlets saying, we don't like the way this is going. They're all stuck in the Tower of London, etc. Elizabeth Lilburn, John Lilburn's wife, puts a very important women's petition to Parliament, which is thrown out by the men. In 1646, in his memoirs, Elias Ashmole records his initiation into Freemasonry at Warrington, 60 years before Freemasonry is supposed to exist in England. Charles I loses the Battle of Newark in November 1646. And then this starts a whole series of bits where Charles is captured and then escapes. And one wonders whether, Martin, they were deliberately letting him escape to sort of almost create this thing of, well, isn't this terrible? Charles has escaped. He's on the run.
Well, I think they once they'd captured him, they really didn't know what to do with him because, you know, they'd been claiming all along that it was they weren't against the existence of the monarchy. They just wanted it to fulfil its, its constitutional role and not usurp, as they saw it, the traditional liberties of the English subject, which were, you know, the things like the Norman yoke. Very
this
much
all started
from this
to
era.
Change. When it comes to 1648, this all started to change, didn't it? About Charles needs to be put on trial.
Well, I mean, eventually they realised that they had gone so far that they couldn't really turn back. If they put him back in power.
I think at this point,
the problem is he was actually negotiating with the parliamentary representatives, but at the same time he was negotiating with the Irish, the French, and anybody else, the Scots.
That will listen.
To try and get basically he wasn't negotiating good faith.
So the point here is that Cromwell and the parliamentarians are starting to realise, well, if the king survives this and carries on as king, he's going to have our guts for garters.
That's right. They said the problem we've got, I'll have to paraphrase it, it's we can win every battle, and yet if he wins one, he is still king and we're all to hang. But if we have to win every battle, if we don't get rid of him, you know, it's like getting rid of Somoza in Nicaragua in 1979. If you don't kill him, he's going to come back.
So, yeah, a bit of a problem at that point. So, anyway, in September 1648, there's a pamphlet called The Freemasons Crushed, or Les Francs-Maçons Écrasés, published nearly a century later. The French Catholic Abbé Laridan alleges in September 1648 that Cromwell, realising his own life will be forfeit if negotiations for peace with Charles proceed, forms a cell to push through the execution of Charles. Now, he's saying this is a kind of Masonic cell stroke witchcraft cell. The idea is a secret society under a Masonic guise. The inauguration takes place in King Street, St. James in London, over two evening meetings, 4 days apart. And there's a whole load of people who are present. And now what he's doing there is he's got all factions in the army and in Parliament present there. And the idea is that these people who are part of this plot will report back to Cromwell over the next few months on everybody's views. And this is actually what it does is it informs something which happens a little bit later in 1648, which is Pride's Purge. On the 1st of December, the House of Commons resists Ireton's calls to proceed to try the king. They vote by 129 to 83, a majority of 46, to accept the king's terms. This is all looking bad for Cromwell. But anyway, the next day, the New Model Army occupies London and arrests 41 MPs who were most actively supporting the king. And on the 6th of December 1648, we have Pride's Purge, acting on orders from Cromwell's son-in-law, General Henry Ireton, and apparently unknown to Army Chief General Fairfax, Thomas Pride, Colonel, surrounds Parliament with troops and purges Parliament of a further 100 or so MPs who voted to negotiate with Charles. This leaves only 71 out of the original nearly 500 MPs still sitting, the so-called Rump Parliament. So then they have a vote, and they vote to try the King. On the 4th of January 1649, Parliament proposed the King be tried for treason, Only 46 of the Rump Parliament's 71 MPs turn up to vote, and 26 vote in favour of a majority of six. And on the 20th of January 1649, a court's convened in Westminster Hall, and Charles I is charged with waging war on Parliament. And he's found guilty, and subsequently on the 30th of January, outside the Old Palace of Whitehall, Charles I is executed. So, so they're in the clear now, Martin, it looks like, and they're going to have to decide what they're going to do, because they knew that Charles were going to come for them, but now he's gone.
Yes, but as you say, they didn't know exactly what they were going to do. I mean, you can do that, but then the question is, well, what are you going to do next?
Well, the next month, they arrest Leveller pamphleteers, because people are up in arms about this. They're writing about it all over the country. John Lilburn, William Wallin, Overton and Thomas Prince are arrested on the Wednesday, the 28th of March, 1649. Cromwell launches his project on the Council of State. That is to say, if you do not break them, they will break you, he says, yea, and bring all the guilt and the blood of the treasure shed and spent in this kingdom on your heads and shoulders. And he proposes all four prisoners are committed to the Tower. I mean, he wins in the Council of State by one vote. The Council of State is now running the country. It's effectively a military dictatorship. And there are petitions for the release of the Levellers come in on the 1st and the 18th of April, 10,000 people signing them, 10,000 signatures from women. These petitions go to the Rump Parliament. But, of course, the Rump Parliament really is just the supporters of Cromwell. So the Agreement of the People is published by the Levellers on the 1st of May, 1649. And then we have in May 1649, the Levellers Day, which I went along to this year in Burford in Oxfordshire. Wages unpaid and refusing to fight in Ireland, hundreds of parliamentary Leveller soldiers sack their officers in Burford. And then they're surrounded by Cromwell and his troop and executed, three of them executed outside the church. So we then, after the Civil War, come to the Golden Age of Piracy. Now, this is a long time. This is 1650 to 1720. But the British secret state sponsorship of pirates is denied, of course. You know, they say the royals say it's nothing to do with us. And the Royal Navy's state within a state works very hard to fulfil John Dee's vision for Britain's dominance of the high seas. So isn't it a shame? It's like, you know, when we say to the poor old Spanish, one of your galleons has gone and been taken over by some pirates. What a shame. Accidents can happen, Martin.
Yeah, and if you think about that timeline that you just said, it's starting with the Navigation Act, which were passed by the parliamentary government, you know, the Republican government, which said that ships trading to England had to be English ships. And it was a kind of protectionist measure. And it led to conflicts with the Dutch, for example, who weren't happy with it. And it is very much the era of the creation of the initial creation of the British Empire. But of course, it continued under the Restoration under Charles II. So, you know, the direction of travel was now clear. And, gradually they established their control over large parts of the earth.
So, 3rd of September 1651, we have the Battle of Worcester, which is Charles II, Charles I's son, coming from Scotland with a small army, and he loses, but he goes on the run until the 15th of October 1651 for 43 days. And the military government and the Puritan, the roundhead soldiers are searching for him all over the country, eventually makes it over to France. And this is really why this Freemasons crushed pamphlet in France is so important, because almost all the disaffected Cavaliers were making their way over to France Henrietta Maria, who was Charles I's wife. She was based in Paris, and so they were all going over there and sharing all their knowledge about what they thought had been going on over here. Then you have the Bare Bones Parliament, which started on the 20th of April 1653. Parliament is really in a terrible state, and everyone is saying, well, you need to have a completely new election, but the army don't want to do that. There's an uprising in Wiltshire, for example, in March 1655, which is put down by Colonel John Penruddock. He's doing the uprising. Cromwell is doing the putting down. But Cromwell himself is put down on the 3rd of September 1658. He dies aged 59, just exactly a year after this so-called, 10 years, a decade after this so-called plot to execute Charles, I mentioned earlier, from the Freemasons Crushed pamphlet. So you have the restoration of Charles II in 1660. Then you have something called the Rye House Plot, which I won't go into. Then 5th of November, William of Orange, 1688, William of Orange lands in Torbay with 14,000 soldiers and 5,000 horses. It's called the Glorious Revolution. It's really a coup d'etat. And it follows as James II is forced into exile in Ireland, while the Protestant William III, King Billy, takes the English throne. This also begins the Catholic Jacobite movement, which is committed to restoring the Stuart line. What happened with the Jacobites, Martin? So there was a kind of resentment about this Glorious Revolution for many, many decades afterwards.
Well, in 1715, the Old Pretender, which was James...
Bonnie Prince Charlie?
Yeah, well, Bonnie Prince Charlie was 1745.
Oh, was it?
Oh, he later. Was the young Pretender. The Old Pretender was his father, James II, or... But, of course, he wasn't. Once he'd been deposed, he wasn't James II anymore.
Right. He says he was over in Ireland.
The Stuart line remained a threat to the new regime.
So what happened in 1715, was it you said?
Well, that was the first uprising against the new order, you know, the Orange Order, if you like.
Oh, right. In, God, not the Orange Order again.
Well, I mean, because the Orange Order, this is where the Orange Order comes from. It's from this era in Ireland.
They're a little bit like the Masons too, aren't they?
Well, I mean, lots of organisations share similar structures. You know, if you look at an organogram of any organisation, you will see that there's a lot of similarities. Most armies look quite similar for obvious reasons.
So Great Britain comes into being in 1707, and that is after the passage of the Treaty of Union with Scotland. And in 1737, Andrew Ramsay reveals the 33 degrees of Scottish Rite Freemasonry. This is something I only came across this week, so named because no degree had ever been issued against the Templars by Scottish monarchs banning the Templars. 1737 that was. And then we had, as Martin referred to there, Bonnie Prince Charlie, as abortive Jacobite rebel march on London, which where they got to Derby, Chris Williamson's hometown, who we'll be hearing from a bit later, the former Labour MP, and went back to Scotland. So my conclusion really is that Charles isn't simply dealing with just a faction of merchants, but it's also a sort of spiritual battle he's been fighting because of the getting rid of the Pope, getting rid of the Vatican. Suddenly the British have got to take on all the responsibility for everything to do with the church. So it's a sort of double-edged sword. You're saying, well, we've had enough of the Pope, but suddenly you've got to take it all on, and they weren't necessarily up to the job.
Well, it was Henry VIII who became the head of the Church of England, the first head of the Church of England, and of course that in Scotland the Reformation was rather different. It was more, you know, bottom up rather than top down. And of course, it's all reflecting what was going on the continent of Europe, the 30 Years' War. And of course, James I's daughter married Prince Frederick of the Palatinate, who was actually the person who tried to invade Bohemia, which began the 30 Years' War. So Prince Rupert of the Rhine had fought in the Protestant cause in the 30 Years' War. So the Stuart dynasty, although it was Church of England, they had very strong Catholic tendencies. And of course Charles II died, as you know, on his deathbed he converted, and James II was even more straightforward. He was a Catholic, and of course to a lot of the Protestant gentry who benefited from the dissolution of the monasteries and supported Parliament during the Civil War, the idea of a Catholic monarch was unthinkable. And of course, it's still the case that a Catholic cannot be the King or Queen of England. And that's on the statute book.
Anyway, I find, you know, looking at this in the context of the attempts to get an empire going, you know, to evict loads of people from the land, to turn Britain into the first country where it's possible to do mass urbanisation, industrial revolution, where you're producing loads of ships, which happened after the Civil War, and all sorts of war equipment to take the world over, that to actually sit the Civil War in that context, as well as this context of witch trials, witchcraft, Freemasonry, the Templars, I found fascinating. And it was, you know, quite a challenge over a year or so, really, to pull this together and to try and turn it into something which is, you know, be very, very happy for people to criticise it. But at least I feel satisfied that I've got my thoughts in order. So there is a reading list as well with this article, which I'll be publishing in the next couple of days. I'll put a link up to it on our show page later at thisweek.org.uk. One is by Dennis Wheatley, the novelist, and also he was a deception planner during the Second World War. That's called Old Rowley, which is a non-fiction book of his about the private life of Charles II, which I found absolutely riveting, rip-roaring read. And it's all about the Restoration, which, of course, was a fantastic time for the arts. Once King Charles II had been restored, lots and lots of Restoration comedies where King Charles II would go along to the theatre and watch people taking the mickey out of him and roar with laughter. That's the kind of thing, attitude we need, which we don't really seem to have in Britain today. It's almost like we've got a new Puritanism, you know, kind of political correctness. And the other one, another one of the books is The Levellers and the English Revolution by Henry Brailsford. Do you want to say something about him, Martin? Because he's quite an important figure, isn't he?
One of the, of that post-war generation of historians who, you know, resurrected the idea of the English Civil War, or War of the Three Kingdoms, whatever you want to call it, as a revolutionary movement. Because, of course, the tendency was, in establishment circles, to simply see the Civil War and the Republic as an aberration. Yeah, if you look at the more conservative history books I was handed as a child, you know, it was regarded as an aberration, and then of course we got back to normal.
Well, no, it was surely the Civil War was when we actually got proper democracy and a parliament rather than the king being in charge.
Well, but it
put the king in his place. Well, this is the way certainly we were taught about the Civil War.
Yes, Civil War put the king in his place. What's called Whig history, and of course in 1066 and all that, Sadler and Yeatman. You know, the famous quote was the Royalists right but romantic. The roundheads wrong but revolting. Right but revolting.
But there's one
wrong but romantic,
particularly
yeah.
good book, I think, about the Civil War, which I came across. Edmund Ludlow and the English Civil War, edited by Jane Shooter, published in 1994. Fascinating account of a parliamentary commander who finds himself slowly losing faith in the cause for which he's been fighting. And a really good accounts by brilliant writer he was, and he's pointing out all the things. Well, hang on, this guy Cromwell is turning out to be even worse than the king. And then Born in Blood, The Lost Secrets of Freemasonry by John J. Robinson. Thank you for one of the listeners, must be probably 2 years ago or so now, for emailing me and saying this is a good book to have a look at. And it certainly was. Extraordinary historical exploration of previously hidden origins of 18th century Freemasonry in ancient and medieval secret societies.
Can I just mention another book in relation to this period, which I read twice during the Brexit standoff in Parliament, which is called The Noble Revolt. I can't remember who wrote it, but it's a relatively recent book, and it's based upon archival stuff which was not available previously.
So the revolt being the Civil War?
Yes, because it was actually orchestrated by the Earl of Warwick, descendant of Warwick the Kingmaker, and various, you know,
the Wars of the Roses guy.
Puritan inclined. And they basically were in cahoots with the Scots in order to try and bring down Charles I. And there's a lot of detail in that book. It's quite a big book, about how that actually happened and how the actual, the actual final run into the Civil War. It's not about
There's little doubt, is there, that King Billy was a usurper?
Well, I mean, what's it they say? Treason doth never prosper. What's the reason? For if treason doth prosper, then none dare call it treason. So in other words, once you've usurped and taken over, William I was a usurper. Mm. It doesn't matter, does it? Once you've won, you're the regime.
Well, I don't know how it's going in Ukraine. It doesn't seem to be going too well. Anyway, The World Turned Upside Down is my 5th book of the 6. That's by Christopher Hill in 1972. He published that detailed analysis of the 17th century counterculture, centred around the Protestant Reformation and agricultural reforms. And finally, The Witch Cult in Western Europe by Margaret Murray, 1921, a study of the underground persistence of secret Canaanite and Phoenician religious cults under the surface of Gentile modern European society. So that's basically it. It's called Enclosure for Empire, Witchcraft, Freemasonry and Oliver Cromwell. But the real title is The Bankrupt Brewer of Huntingdon and Solomon's Temple, an untold story of the English Civil War. Solomon's Temple, of course, is very important today, Martin, isn't it? It's a focus over in Jerusalem still. And there's still these attempts by the Third Temple groups in Israel to rebuild that Third Temple. Amazing that some of this sort of links back right the way back to the times of Cromwell.
Well, right the way back to the times of Jesus. I mean, in a sense, you know, everything in history is connected to everything else because it just is, isn't it?
So, there is also something probably worth mentioning, which I came across recently, which was people talking about the idea of rebuilding Solomon's temple as the idea of your body is your temple, rebuilding the body. So this links in potentially anyway with transhumanism and the idea of, well, we can just redesign humans to live forever and this sort of thing.
Well, those are very big topics. I mean, all sorts of things. You know, human culture is incredibly fecund. There's all sorts of new ideas constantly bubbling up, and they're connected to old ideas reinterpreted. You know, there's always room for discussion of all these things, but don't presume that everything is just explained by one simple explanation. That's what modern historians are very aware of, how there's a lot of contingency in history.
I'm just thinking
things might have been different,
but
they weren't.
Thinking about today's show, it's a bit past, present, and future. We've just been in the past. We're going to go on to the present in a moment.
Go down, Moses, way down in Egypt land. Land.
Let my people go.
Oppressed so hard they could not stand.
Let my people go.
So the Lord said, go down.
Go down.
Moses.
Moses.
Way
down.
Down in Egypt land. Tell old Pharaohs to let my people go.
Let my people go.
So Moses went to Egypt land.
Let my people go.
He made old Pharaoh understand.
Let my people go.
Yes, the Lord said, go down.
Go down.
Moses.
Moses.
Way
down.
Down in Egypt land. Tell all Pharaohs to let my people go.
Let my people go.
Firstborn dead.
Let my people go.
'Cause the Lord said, go down.
Go down.
Moses.
Moses.
Way
down.
Down in Egypt land. Tell old Pharaoh
to let my people go.
Well, that's 1965, Louis Armstrong and Go Down Moses. No, really, just a sort of gentle apology, really, for anyone that wasn't expecting our kind of past look in the past. I do these from time to time. I did one on the Arnhem Battle, the Traitors of Arnhem. I did also one on bomber beaching, which is a really quite deep investigation into one particular topic, trying to get right to the bottom of it and articulate it and evidence it. And the beaching one is about the shutdown of the railways in the 1960s, what the real reasons for that were, to do with the oil industry, control of energy, you know, stopping coal and making oil the new thing, which now has proved to be such a disaster. But I think, you know, it's well worth doing these from time to time. It's looking really as you know, deep into these things as we possibly can. But anyway, right back to the minute, Martin. Big rail strike going on. We're going to be talking about that in a minute. But mainly, the big story for me right now is being talked about journalists all across Britain and all across Europe, which is this, possibly the world, I don't know. It's in the journalistic papers, magazines, etc., which is the Mayor of Bristol, Marvin Rees, telling one of the local democracy reporters who's paid, he's basically a civil servant, he's paid by the BBC to go and report on these council meetings, that he's now banned from the press conferences as of this week. And this is Alex Seabrook, new to the job. It looks almost as if they're trying to make an example of him as a new local journalist. Adam Postens is the other local democracy reporter here. And we had Amanda Cameron from New Zealand. She was another local democracy reporter who left earlier in the year. And Alex has just taken up the job. I said it was a difficult city to work in, and it looks like I was right. I think the best way to start looking at this story is to have a listen to the discussion at the last mayor's press conference, where Marvin Rees is asked by this new local democracy reporter, Alex Seabrook, why he flew to Vancouver to do a talk about climate change.
Your TED talk was very interesting. I thought you made some good points. But I wondered, firstly, if you saw the irony in flying so far for a talk on climate change, and secondly, why you couldn't use Zoom instead.
Okay, so you liked the talk. Did you deal with the argument? Yeah. What did you think of the argument I made in it?
Yeah, I thought it was very interesting, but I just wondered about the irony of flying so far.
Right. Okay. It's much cool. So let's work through this. Do you know what the fundamental argument I made in the talk was?
Sure. Sorry, I thought we were asking you questions rather than the other.
Yeah, I know, but I'm just trying to see if we're on the same ground. The argument I made in the TED talk, the fundamental argument was,
sorry, the question was, do you see the irony in flying so far?
Yeah, I'm saying, but that depends on what the argument in the talk was. I'm saying,
elected mayor stepping up, right, to tackle climate change. We have to work together. We need the finance, we need the investment.
And mayors need to, well, I'll help you out. So the argument was that mayors need to be involved in shaping national and international policy. So that's what that was. So there's no irony because I was there shaping national and international policy. The argument was we can't leave it to national politicians because they're failing. We saw that at COP. So let me take you through the argument in case, just if you engage with it. You need to decarbonize the world's cities because that's where most people live. And through cities, you can you can make more lives more efficient than through any other form of human organization more quickly. At the moment, the national and international context in which we work is not supporting cities to decarbonize, right? It's not coherent. So what we are doing as cities is not waiting. We need national governments to work with us, but we're not waiting for them. So we are going out and we are working together to raise finance, as we do with the UK Climate Investment Commission, for example. And we're working together to shape national and international policy. So that's it. Have you seen any TED conferences that were run by Zoom?
Not yet, but it might be a good idea.
Okay, well, you probably want to write to TED then about that. But Zoom wasn't on the table. I mean, Bill Gates was there, Al Gore was there talking about climate change, Elon Musk was there, you know. And I think one of the things we could do is talk about how fantastic it, you know, it's great for Bristol as a city of less than 500,000 people. We are being asked to take a platform at TED. And and shape global thinking, actually, which has actually begun to echo from that. See, the argument, so the question is the argument coherent and does it stack up? And if it's coherent and it stacks up, the question is, how do you get the biggest platform for that argument? If the argument stacks up and then we lead to unlocking or contributing to the unlocking of billions, potentially into trillions of pounds to invest in cities, not just in the global north, but in the global south, then it's about how do you maximize the platform for that? I mean, all the best will in the world getting it on Bristol Life website ain't going to give us that platform, is it?
Sure, well, thank you very much. And on that topic then of getting the investment.
Alex, may I just ask a question, if I may? Just in terms of, sorry, your role as an LDR. So from my understanding, it would be to, you know, report and provide impartial coverage.
This is the council's head of communications.
Sort of the regular sort of workings of local authorities and public sector bodies. And so I suppose my question is that, Marvin was fully funded by TED. To attend this conference. So I couldn't quite understand what the role as an LDR would be in asking those questions.
Well, because it's holding the people who lead local authorities to account, Marvin obviously being the lead of Bristol City Council, and there are obviously questions with the huge amount of carbon emissions from flying so far. So I think it's a legitimate question to ask.
I think it is from probably in a journalist from a newspaper, etc. But I can't quite see the link to LDR. But I'll leave it there. And you had a second question.
Yes, if that's okay. So it's on the.
If you need to, but I would just say, well, I would ask, and this is why I'm so pleased that the big tent is here on Friday. Please be familiar with the actual substance of the arguments. And not just the tweets that are around it when we're asking questions about things. It really helps the city engage with a debate as it actually is, rather than just the heat of the, you know, the social media.
So the actual question, I suppose the answer to the question, do you see the irony in flying so far to do a talk about climate change, is no, I don't.
Well,
that would have been a lot easier. But instead, what we got from the Mayor Marvin Rees was something like between eight and ten questions to the journalist. Now, this is not the point of a press conference. And Marvin's basic argument is that by flying out there, I can get a bigger platform. Well, he could have done that on Zoom. Maybe he just wants to hobnob with people like Elon Musk, Bill Gates and Al Gore.
He probably does. But in any case, there is I don't necessarily agree with him. But Marvin could make the case, look, we can't be silly about this. We're trying to deal with climate change, but doesn't mean that everybody can't fly on aeroplanes. Yeah. Sometimes you may have to fly on aeroplanes. Now, that doesn't mean that it's justified in this case.
Sounds to me, Martin, like you should be his director of communications. Well, that would have been a much better answer.
What he did there is what Boris Johnson does when he's asked a direct question, is he turns it around and says, well, I was there because I'm trying to deal with climate change, and it's not just a question of my air miles. But and the point was made by his communications director that it was actually paid for by TED.
But that's not
in
the
other
point.
Words,
it
by the people who set the conference
up. It doesn't matter who it's paid for. He's still the state carbon is being blurted out into the atmosphere, isn't it?
The point he would make is, does that mean that nobody can ever fly on aeroplanes
at all? It doesn't. He
well, in that
it,
case, he's made the case it, that he I could, think he was
could have done it on Zoom. He could have done it on Zoom.
Yes, but he's made the case that, as far as he was concerned, he wants to go there, and he thinks it's a justifiable use of air miles. Now, you may disagree with that, and you may say it's hypocritical, and the question he was asked is the sort of question he's going to have to answer if he does things like that, and he's tried to answer it by saying, well, I think in this case it was a justifiable thing to do. Now, you may or may not disagree with that, but I think we're going to go on to find that he's banned this guy from future press conferences, which I think is a big, you know, that's a different step again, isn't it? It's not saying, well, I don't agree with the question, I think I was justified in going there, but to say that I don't want to see you again, I don't want to hear any questions from you, well, that's another matter, isn't it?
Yeah, well, so there's been various ramifications yesterday, the BBC reporting local democracy reporters are excluded now from the Bristol Mayor's briefings. Local democracy reporters have been excluding from formal mayor briefings in Bristol as a video went viral of the head of external communications querying a reporter's right to ask a question. So the I'm stunned to see, says the publicly funded external communications person at the mayor's press release, seemed to ask the local Democracy reporter to justify his question. So this is Jo Booth, who's the wife of Martin Booth, who's the editor of Bristol 24/7, and she's been on this show in the past, actually. She's a very prolific blogger. The local Democracy reporters are funded by the BBC, but they're now banned from going to these press conferences, Martin.
Well, I mean, this is a general tendency across the world. Boris Johnson refused to be interviewed by...
It's not the same as banning people from press conferences. It's not the same, is it?
Trump didn't have press conferences. Biden doesn't have press conferences.
Trump most definitely did have press conferences, and all the press were invited. In fact, there were sparks flying as a proper press conference should be.
Biden certainly does not allow people who are not vetted into his press conferences. And it's becoming more general that communications directors who are trying to get their people re-elected, that's, at the end of the day, that's what they're trying to do, they take the view that they're not necessarily going to answer hostile questions. They're under no legal obligation to invite anybody to their press conferences.
Yeah, but so no one's going to know what they're doing.
It's like blocking.
It's exactly the same as he's been blocking loads of people on Twitter.
Yes,
like including the leader of the opposition in Bristol. I mean, this is just childish tactics. Let me bring you up to date with it.
Yeah.
Bristol Mayor sparks press boycott, joined by BBC and ITV now after this anti-democratic local Democracy reporting ban. This is in the Press Gazette today.
Yeah.
ITV's regional newsroom in the Bristol area is the latest to join the media boycott of the Bristol Mayor's press briefings. Ian Axton, head of news at ITV West Country, said the West Country News stands by other media organisations on this issue. We will not attend the fortnightly press briefings held by the Mayor until the exclusion of local Democracy reporters is lifted. Bristol Mayor Marvin Rees is facing a widespread boycott of his briefings after his comms team banned local Democracy reporters from attending the press conferences. Reach-owned Bristol Live, that is the website for the Bristol Post, independent outlet Bristol 24/7, and National World-owned Bristol World have also said their entire newsrooms would now boycott press briefings. Well, he's kind of shot himself in the foot here, Martin, hasn't he?
Well, he may well have done, but you will find that this tendency to avoid awkward questions is becoming widespread across the political spectrum, because there is actually, from a getting elected point of view, if you avoid difficult questions, you've got more chance of being re-elected. Now, maybe it's wrong, but I mean, Marvin won the election.
You know, Martin, you know
Biden
exactly
won the election, etc.
As well as I do, you know exactly what's going on here. This is the corporate press attitude. So say, for example, if this lady was the corporate communications director of Shell, she would be picking and choosing which journalists would want to talk to. But she's not. She's the corporate communications director of a public body called Bristol City Council that's supposed to represent the public.
Yes, and those who don't like it will criticise what's happening, and they are. You're criticising it now. But of course, they're under no legal obligation to do anything. I mean, the idea, for example, that, you know, the comms directors are like
a corporation, a company,
yes,
that's for profit, but they are not for profit. Anyway, I just thought it'd be useful to hear some of what Marvin was actually saying over in Vancouver and whether it was really worth going all that distance in his TED talk. And if you can decipher this, you're doing pretty well, as Gary Hopkins and other Lib Dem leaders in the past have said here in Bristol. It sounds to me like management speak gobbledygook, but here he is, putting his case, change the world, over in Vancouver with the likes of Elon Musk, Bill Gates and Al Gore.
So here's my call to action. We need to work with the world's mayors to develop a global plan for cities. It's a plan that must decarbonize and build efficiency into existing cities, but to make sure that the future processes of urbanization maximize city efficiency. And when I say global, I do mean global. It's a plan that must transcend national boundaries. It must be in the global north, and it must be in the global south, where 90% of future urbanization is going to take place. And it's a plan that must have us move beyond our narrow self-national interest. We must come to see the world's cities as international assets rather than national possessions. We must come to see that investing in the increased efficiency of the world's cities is key to our future. It's going to be key to unlocking our potential. and it's an investment in our global common good. When I was elected mayor of Bristol in 2016, I had a limited appreciation of the global role of the city. And by extension, I had a limited appreciation of the level of responsibility that was therefore falling on my shoulders as a newly elected mayor of a major UK city. In the years since, I've come to understand that cities, the way they are planned, the way they function, the way they grow, and the way they innovate, will be key to whether we are or are not successful in taking on this challenge to stem the tide of global climate change. If we can unlock the full potential of our cities, we can minimize the price the planet pays for hosting us in our growing numbers. I think efficient cities could be one of the most effective tools we have. So I ask you to work with us to build them. Thank you.
So that's Marvin Rees, Bristol Mayor, speaking over in Vancouver after his climate change inducing flight. But maybe it's a good idea that he went to say it. But for me, Martin, this is just blancmange. He's not really saying anything there. It's just I don't know if he writes his own speeches. I suppose he probably does. But this may have been one of the reasons that he didn't do too well at the BBC. He doesn't seem to actually be able to get his point across. It's almost like he's coming up with a series of kind of strap lines trying to sell soap powder. In terms of, the city's going to be successful, it's going to be efficient, but he doesn't really say anything at the end of the day.
Yeah, I think that's fair comment. There's a tendency for everybody in this debate to just say, you know, virtue signal, you know. Isn't it terrible we've got this climate change?
It's not just that.
We've all got to work together to stop it.
He's saying you've got to follow us, but he's not really spelling out any kind of real vision.
Well, when he says we've got to have more efficient cities, what does he mean? The obvious thing to do, for example, in many places, is have free public transport. But you can't do that because it's against the law in Britain. So what's he talking about? Most cities in Britain basically don't have the powers to do the kind of things that he's talking about. You've got to have changes in national policy to give the cities the powers to do the things he's talking about. So you can't just go round national policy, because national policy determines what cities can and can't do, unless you've got a city state like Singapore. Otherwise, cities are embedded within a national polity, which will then determine what powers they do or do not have. And of course, in Britain, cities do not have any powers, really. So, you know, it's a lot of hot air, isn't it? Literally.
I think it is, yeah. Okay, so let's move on to look at the rail strike now. And this is the first 3 days, that is to say, on Tuesday this week, Thursday and tomorrow, Saturday, of a national rail strike. Before we hear from Andrew Haynes, who gets paid around about £700,000 a year as the chief executive officer of Network Rail, Martin, what do you think of the rights and wrongs of this? They're saying basically they want to modernise the network, turn it into this sort of place where they don't have any ticket offices anymore, and people are buying their train tickets on apps and, you know, with smartphones and goodness knows what, and that will actually make it a lot cheaper to run.
Well, it's modernisation. What they mean by modernisation is, it's basically get rid of the trade unions and then everything will be okay. The problem they've got is that the RMT is actually probably one of the strongest unions in this country, and they're in a position to, and it looks as if they're winning the battle of public opinion as well. Don't forget, it's these workers that kept on going during the pandemic lockdowns, and they were going into work at considerable personal risk and all the rest of it. Everybody was going on about the key workers this, the key workers that. And of course,
now they're being told to take a pay cut. But anyway, I thought we'd have a listen to the boss of Network Rail first. He's Andrew Haynes here. As he talks about this whole, there's a bit of a dispute going on in the background of all of this as to whether the government is actually involved or not in the negotiations.
Are you concerned that this is the start of perhaps more action?
Look, I hope that we can avoid those further strikes. I think the RMT have said they are prepared to take more action, but at this stage, we've got time to talk to them, to try to thrash out the basis of a deal that is actually acceptable to our colleagues in Network Rail and actually allows us to run these services. So,
Would you like the government to get involved more? I talked to the boss of a pub chain earlier who said, look, the government needs to stop union bashing and get more involved and help sort this out. Could the government play a bigger role here, in your opinion?
Well, look, I very much doubt that pub chain boss has his shareholders around the negotiating table. And I don't think that's a model that works anywhere in the economy. These are quite detailed conversations, negotiations around fundamental changes to working practices. The best people to do that are the union that representing colleagues and myself and my colleagues as leaders of the business. The government is the shareholder. It sets a context, but it should not be involved in those detailed negotiations. It would create a wonderful media story, but it wouldn't make resolving this any better at all. It would make it harder.
So that's Andrew Haynes there. Not entirely denying that the government are involved, Martin. He sort of skirts around the subject, but he's saying it would be, this is a way, make a great media story, but actually it's not really happening. But there is some dispute about whether the government are involved or not.
Well, clearly they are, because of the, you know, de facto nationalisation of the railways as a result of the pandemic.
But are they involved in the detailed negotiations as to whether the strike's whether there's going to be a settlement or the strike's going to carry on?
Yeah, but I mean, ultimately, the RMT know very well that what they're up against is the Tory government, and that the people that they're talking to, the representing the shareholders, and Network Rail, the main shareholder, is the government, and that they need the government, for example, to underpin any solution with government money. Now, therefore, the government willy-nilly are involved. And what the government are doing is pushing the Network Rail people forwards to confront the RMT, with the government saying, well, we're not going to get involved. Back in the 1970s, governments would definitely have been involved, not necessarily negotiating with the unions, but bringing the employers and the unions together and making sure, knocking heads together, basically.
The Department for Transport may be now, we don't know. But anyway, we're going to find out, I hope, by hearing from Mick Lynch, who's the General Secretary of the Rail Maritime Transport Union, who did a pretty good explanation of what's really going on with the dispute back on the Wednesday evening Robert Peston show.
Workers who do the inspections and the maintenance is 2,900 jobs. And they've given, the numbers they've quoted to us and they've put on documents and pushed them across the table, is 2,900. In the train operators, the other side of the equation, there is an unknown amount of jobs to be cut, because they want to close, and they are going to close, every ticket office in Britain. They're saying that we have to adopt different contracts of employment, fire and rehire, where all new entrants will have lower wages, worse conditions, and they're going to extend the working week from 35 hours to 40. Now, this is the form of what the P&O did. And the P&O director, the criminal that broke the law and was condemned by Grant Shapps and everyone else, he said that no trade union could accept what he was proposing. And the government is now sponsoring proposals that we can never accept. A trade union can never go in to a negotiation that's about job security and pay levels and say, look, I've come out of this deal. What a great deal I've got. I've got you extended working hours, and the salaries are actually reduced. Not against inflation, against the existing salaries. We can't tolerate this. And it's an attempt to have super exploitation and bring all the precarious work we've got in our economy into the mainstream employment model of the railways and other public services. We say that in order to negotiate the changes they want, which are flexibility, automation, digitalisation, new technology deployment, we can negotiate that in a framework of no.
And you're not objecting to modernisation of that?
Well, we can't object to modernisation. It's like resisting the tide or the wind. Sure. It's ridiculous. We used to have a union of 500,000 people. Our union is now 82,000 people. We don't have steam. We don't have Stevenson's rocket. We went through dieselisation, electrification, digitalisation.
So talk to me about how you would like to see this negotiated.
Well, we'll do it with the employers. And I think the employers are ready to do the deal with us. It's the government that is stopping them negotiating freely and bargaining in a traditional, coherent way.
Whatever
they leave
have,
the room,
this is, but whatever
this is really
this
important,
is
Robert. They leave the room. They make a phone call for 45 minutes. They talk to the DfT. They talk to the Treasury, and they come back and they put worse things on the table than before the adjournment. That is happening every day that we go.
Did
and
it
meet
happen
them.
Today?
Yes, it happened this morning.
And how did that happen? What's
the train
that?
Operating company said to me this morning, we're going to go back to the disputes on the role of the guard, which we've had for the last 5 or 6 years, which has mainly settled down now, and we've got agreements. We're going to bring that dispute back to you straight away, and we want to change the role of the guard, take them off the trains, change their responsibilities and go back to disputes that have already been settled. And on top of that, the people that do those jobs will be paid less than the existing people. That's why they want some of the redundancies, so they can rinse out existing staff on good contracts and get low-paid, exploited people in. This is what's happened in aviation over the last year or so. In aviation, all the good jobs at Gatwick, Stansted, etc., and Heathrow have been rinsed out of the system. People are now being exploited on £9 and £10 an hour, and nobody wants to work there.
Do you think that the attitude of government is that they want the dispute to continue? Do they think somehow it's good for them?
I think they plan to have this dispute continuing. I think they plan strategically to take it on, but I think they're shocked by the reaction. The support we're getting online, on the picket lines, and from letters from the public, and from other trade unions has been astounding. They're not getting the level of support they'd want. They think they're going to condemn everyone as communists and Marxists and all the rest of it. We've got ordinary men and women who I think are heroes who are conducting this dispute and tell me what to do for our democratic processes. And they're sick of being made poorer by this Tory government.
We're talking about the current offer from the government on pay for those not affected by those changes.
They've offered us 2%. And there's a further 1% available if we accept all of the redundancies.
So the 1% is linked to the so-called modernisation.
It's what's called a conditional offer.
Right.
The condition is you can have 1% extra if you accept the entire agenda of change that they want to put through. But they're even saying the 2% is conditional on that as well. But you can have that as a down payment. That is not acceptable. It doesn't meet the retail price index that we use. And let's not forget, our members, most of them have not had a pay rise for 2 or 3 years now. They were subject to the public sector pay freeze and have had nothing. And our members are struggling. And most of our people in this dispute are on salaries between £25,000 and £30,000 a year for shift work round the clock, 7 days a week, out on the track, all weathers.
And just to be...
And they've been told to do that, Robert, by people who are fundamentally wealthy.
Well, yes. In fact, there are something like 15 senior executives at Network Rail that get paid more than £300,000, Martin. It's absolutely fantastic salaries. And these people, of course, never meet the public. Those that are on strike are the ones that are actually dealing with the public day to day.
Well, what I hope is that we are now getting a resurgence of traditional attitudes in Britain towards industrial disputes and industrial relations.
But it's an interesting one of the things he said there, talking about them going out of the room, talking to the Department for Transport, coming back in the room. So the department, it's quite obvious that Network Rail and the train operating companies are really doing, are not, as he says, not free to negotiate on their own. We had Andrew Haynes just a minute ago saying, oh, this is some silly story from the press. It makes a great story. But it's actually happening that the Department for Transport are, in fact, he was talking there about saying, well, why don't we just throw this in just to make things even worse by tearing up agreements that were made years ago and putting them on the table again?
Well, I think what they're trying to do is what P&O did at Hull. It's to get rid of the existing trade unions, ultimately, and they're trying to use the dispute as a means to do that. And, of course, it doesn't make real sense in relation to... I mean, do the public really want temporary people driving trains? Is that sensible at all? Of course it isn't. And I think if you actually look at public opinion, the majority of people in this country, including Conservative voters, want to go back to having a nationalised railway. Now that's
well, three of the train companies are now nationalised. Right, Southern, Northern Rail in the northwest, and the LNER, I think, it's the East Coast Main Line, are all in public hands.
Well, that's right, and it should never have been privatised in the first place.
So these are fundamental
infrastructure like this needs to be publicly owned because there isn't any competition between rail companies, is it? They don't, you know, it's just absurd. How many trains can run down a track?
From Mick Lynch on the Peston show was the government are most definitely behind these the failures of these negotiations, and they actually, it seems to sort of entertain the Department for Transport to make this strike last as long as possible. All the time they're blaming the Royal Maritime Transport Union and people like Mick Lynch for it. It's actually them that's put a spanner in the works.
Yeah, I think what the calculation by the Tory government is that if this dispute drags on over the summer, they can use it as a stick to beat Starmer with. And of course, Starmer has said that any front bench person who turns up on the picket lines will be disciplined, because he's trying to distance himself from the strike.
Yeah, I see Angela Rayner, for example, said that she supported the strike, but she wouldn't turn up on a picket
line.
Well,
She's being
a good girl.
Yes, well, it's already the case that several front bench spokespeople for the Labour Party have turned up on picket lines. So,
They been sacked?
Well, no, the problem for Starmer is if you make threats like that and then don't carry out the threat, you look silly, which is probably wiser to say nothing. Yeah, and not to try, he's, and of course this is what the Tories want to do. They want to get Starmer condemning the strike, which then causes problems with their trade union base of the Labour Party. The RMT, isn't affiliated with the Labour Party, but I think it's still influential. And it's playing politics.
On the Peston show, they also had, a little section where they asked the public, what does Labour think about the strike? That is to say, the public perception of whether the Labour Party has actually managed to get across its thoughts on the strike to the general public.
Do people know what Labour's position is? The polling suggests not really. A fifth say they are anti-strikes, 28% say neither for or against, but the biggest number here, 43%, say they just don't know.
Thanks, Anoushka. So, Emily was trying to explain Labour's position on industrial action just now. Are you any the wiser?
Well, I know plenty of Labour MPs that support us actively, and that's great. I'll take support from anyone that wants to give it, whether you're a Liberal or Labour or a Democratic Unionist. I don't mind. And some of those people did that in the P&O dispute. It's interesting that where you get a clear-cut thing like P&O, where there's a common enemy and everybody hates the company, everybody's allowed to stand behind the trade unions. Where we get a straightforward industrial dispute, where the employers at the behest of the government are trying to make people poorer, and they're doing that right across the economy, nobody wants to come to our aid, and we have to do it ourselves.
Well, I think the problem for the right wing of the Labour Party, which is now in ascendant, is that they want to be seen to be respectable managers of capitalism by the people that run the show. And I can understand why the Labour Party might say we don't want to. You know, what ought to happen here is negotiations to end the strike. We're not in favour of strikes just for the hell of it. That's a legitimate position. But I think you've also got to recognise that probably what's going to happen going forward is, because of the attacks on people's wages and living standards and so on, there is going to be quite naturally a backlash from those who are organised. I know I work in schools and people are very fed up with lack of resources, pay restraint and all the rest of it. And don't forget, everybody's been involved in the pandemic and all the rest of it. Everybody's all supposed to be working together. We're all united in trying to get keep the country on the rails, as it were. And then suddenly they turn around and we're just back to the same old, we want to get rid of you and cut your wages.
Well, I'm actually saying, you just want the government's got a program to make people poorer, and they expect people
which
just
of course
to
if they make people poorer, which is what they're doing, that will in itself crash the economy. So it's not even a rational
It's interesting
policy.
I think, you know, this whole business, I think for me this is the big take home from this week, is that the government actually is running this dispute. It's telling the train operating companies and Network Rail, of course, which it controls and owns, and of course three of those, as I said, those train operating companies are owned by the Department for Transport, is Grant Shapps, the Transport Secretary, is trying to pretend he's nothing to do with it.
The Transport Secretary, Grant Shapps, said it was a stunt to suggest he was interfering in talks, and described the strikes as a bid to derail reform.
You no longer need to have people walking along dangerously along tracks to check those tracks. It's better, more efficient, safer to use trains which can take 70,000 images per minute to check those tracks, and uses fewer employees. So there are good reasons why. And that's the kind of modernisation which would improve safety, which is being held back.
Passenger numbers have been rising. The latest data shows that by May, the number of passengers had risen to between 86 and 92% of pre-COVID levels. Now, the unions say there are also bigger problems with the way that the industry is run. £16 billion was pumped into the industry by taxpayers during the pandemic to keep the network going. But the RMT says that just helped boost profits for private businesses, subcontractors and operators, who they claim made £500 million in profit last year. And on top of that, there's the cost of leasing passenger carriages and other train vehicles, the so-called rolling stock, from private companies. So the RMT says that's helped those firms make a record £3 billion in revenue in 2021. Now, we asked Network Rail and the Department for Transport about that figure. They say they weren't sure how it had been calculated and couldn't provide an alternative.
Ben, thank you very much.
So that's a bit of Grant Shapps, and then a few figures. This is, I think, one of the most fascinating aspects of this. £16 billion pumped into the railway network. The staff quite clearly haven't seen very much of that. They've certainly had no increase in pay over those last few years. And that money has all gone to shareholders of the various rackets involved in running the railways.
Well, it's gone to keep the railway functioning so that it went, you know, after the pandemic.
These businesses are very profitable.
Well, they are, yes. And if and that's, very, that's, very the, high case, that's the case for the whole thing to be nationalised.
Unbelievable Why wages anybody... being paid to the people running it.
Ultimately, railways have to be subsidised to some extent, particularly commuter railways. Yeah. And
Andrew Haynes is getting paid £700,000. Yeah. That's not a public sector wage, is it?
No. And of course, in the old days of British Rail, you know, it was all nationalised in the 1940s. It was nationalised because ultimately rail is a national infrastructure. It's not there to make a profit necessarily. It's there to provide the infrastructure for other private businesses to make a profit because the railway's there as a kind of basic support mechanism to the way the society functions.
It does seem to me like
so
a
that all
bit
the commuter trains into London make London viable as a city, but you can't expect to make money moving people back and forwards.
Dish out that racket to some of your mates, as the Conservatives have done over the years, starting with John Major.
That's right.
Anyway, so let's have a listen now to Andrew Haynes again. This is the Chief Executive Officer of Network Rail, their CEO, talking on the BBC.
Let me come back to the first question, which I asked you today, and I know that that's not directly the bit of the negotiations that you're involved in, but do you think a pay offer being made literally just yesterday on the eve of these strikes was very late in the day, really, to try to stop them? Wouldn't it have been more sensible for that pay offer to have been made earlier in the talks process as a basis perhaps for ongoing negotiation?
Look, I don't agree with that, Anita, because I've been involved in negotiations over many years. And the truth of the matter is a strike is not a reality, until a few hours before it's activated. And a pay offer that was made, you know, yesterday morning, there was plenty of time for there to be negotiations and for the strike to be called off. Or indeed for the RMT to do what most of the trade unions would do, which would be to put that offer to its membership, allow the membership to decide on whether or not they still wanted to take strike action once they had visibility of the offer. Now, in our case,
if the offer was made yesterday morning, a little bit late in the day to ask the membership if they still wanted to pursue strike action, don't you think?
Well, look, the nature of the legislation in this country means that the RMT have got 6 months now when they can call strikes. So these strikes today didn't have to go ahead. The RMT would have lost nothing by saying, OK, we're going to pause, see what people think about that offer, maybe a negotiate around it. They could have always have called subsequent strike dates. Their mandate lasts until November. So there was no reason to rush into this action. It's needless disruption. It's going to cost their members and my colleagues in Network Rail serious, you know, financial harm. It'll cost the railway financial harm and, of course, devastate lots of people. We've heard of students wanting to finish their final exams, people visiting hospitals, you know, people to this country who are really facing a very poor service as a consequence. None of that's in anyone's interest.
So that's Network Rail's Chief Executive Officer Andrew Haynes again. He's admitting there is that, well, we left it right to the very last minute to make them a decent offer. Now, that's not a responsible attitude of a boss. I would suggest that maybe Grant Shapps and the Department for Transport are behind that.
Yeah, and I think this is ultimately a trial of strength. The RMT knows that their members support them because they have been very tough in negotiations over many years with employers. And that's why people join the
RMT. They've got them decent pensions, all that sort of thing.
That's right. And the trade unions have to demonstrate to their members that they have a purpose, that they're not just window dressing. And that means once in a while, you have to show that we walk the talk.
We don't just.
Well, but there's been supposedly no real negotiations between the Rail Maritime Transport Union and the Conservative Party and the government at all. But there was on Peston with one of these Tory MPs. It was quite nice to hear.
We need to encourage those people back. The worst way in which you can do that is by alienating your customers, by going on strike and making their lives much more difficult.
The worst way you could do it is insist that the fares go up by RPI, ripping off the commuters, but you won't give the workers RPI. The fares go up by RPI every year, the retail price index. That's the government regulations. Last year, profits were made by the train operators. £500 million out of that subsidy you gave went to those companies. First Group and Go Ahead, who we're negotiating with, are both subject to takeovers from private equity companies. They're going to be worth billions because they know that you're going to keep siphoning money from the public purse into private sector operators, health, education, and care.
So there, I think that's quite an excellent riposte to that Conservative, Martin. He's saying, look, actually, you're just siphoning money into the hands of private equity firms, and that's why they like you.
Yeah, and of course, the RMT ultimately is basically putting down the throwing down the gauntlet, saying we need to have a nationalised railway like we used to have, and then we can use it as a national asset to deal with all sorts of problems we may face, whether it's pandemics, climate change, whatever it may be.
Well, it's also the question of money and where, how much money we've got, how much or what we can spend. And I put this question to Chris Williamson, because the government's always saying we haven't got enough money to pay these people, blah, blah. Of course we have. And the former Labour MP, Chris Williamson, I spoke to earlier this week, he has got some, I think, pretty interesting ideas about whether it's okay to just make this money up and pay it to the rail workers if we want to. So, yeah, this is a sort of 5 minutes or so long, but it's Chris William explaining how we can run a deficit without any problem since we're in the UK and we control our own currency.
We've run a deficit virtually every year since, you know, for kind of 100 or 200 years or more. Look, in a country like Britain, which has its own sovereign currency, I mean, it's the government that issues the money. So we can never run out of money. Money is no object for a government. So rather than using the economy to balance the budget, we should be using the budget to balance the economy and otherwise to create a good society. And, you know, the government should be, you know, for example, I mean, I think a radical progressive socialist government could be committing to full employment, you know, investing in our infrastructure, investing in housing, a Green New Deal, improving our public services, which have, you know, been in meltdown for God knows how long. I mean, they're in a shocking state. And, you know, there's no inflationary problem by investing in the economy, so long as you're spending up to the capacity of the economy. This is the public spending, this is the capacity of the economy to absorb that spend. Well, it's quite clear that there's massive capacity at the moment. We've got lots of people who are underemployed. We have massive needs in terms of, as I've already mentioned, you know, infrastructure improvements and so on. And so, you know, anything that's for sale in our own currency in pound sterling, I mean, you know, the government can just find the money, just, you know, create the money. I mean, that's what we saw the government do when we saw the neoliberal banking crash, which should have seen a reset but didn't. But they were quite happy to, you know, create hundreds of billions of pounds to bail out the banks through quantitative easing. And when they talk about, you know, government borrowing, that's a misnomer, you know. Because the vast bulk of so-called government borrowing is borrowing money from essentially the Bank of England. So the Bank of England creates it, provides it for the government, and the government's saying it's borrowing the money. It's nonsense. And you know, any government bonds which are bought in the, you know, the private sector is merely a just a kind of bookkeeping exercise in the Treasury. A few keystrokes on a keypad in the Treasury by a Treasury functionary to redeem any bonds, you know, any government bonds which is held by the private sector. So, you know, there is no real issue there. I mean, I think, as I've said, the government should be there to, you know, for the public good. It should be, you know, setting goals, if you like, mission oriented budgeting, you know, to create that good society that everybody would benefit from. And, you know, by investing in infrastructure and housing and so on, I mean, you'd be creating economic growth. You're creating jobs, as it were, for people in the country. It's just a lack of political will. And you know, people have been, you know, sold a pup really in relation to, you know, the economy and, you know, oh, can we afford this, that and the other? And, you know, the economy, the British economy is not like a household budget. And that's how it's often explained, you know, in the media and indeed by politicians. Even, you know, John McDonnell, when he was Shadow Chancellor, spoke in those terms. And that's kind of neoliberal framing. And it kind of gives the impression that, you know, somehow you need the billionaire class in order to create the good society because you need the tax revenue from the billionaires. No, you don't. I mean, when Lord Sugar said that if Corbyn came to power, he would leave the country, my response was, great, I'll drive you to the airport. We don't need the billionaire class. As far as I'm concerned, they can all be off. They're a drain, frankly, on our society. And, you know, taxation isn't used to provision the government. Taxation is used to create a value for the currency, to, you know, drive behavior change, to encourage people, you know, for example, to use environmentally friendly vehicles and things like that. And to address inflation. So if the economy is overheating, they can taxation can be used to take out some of that heat in the economy, and also where to enable, you know, if you like, to create space. So if the economy, say, is working at full tilt, but we want to have a big infrastructure program or whatever, we want a big public spending program, but there isn't the kind of, you know, spare capacity to be able to absorb that, you're going to create an inflationary pressure. So what do you do? Well, you can tax out some of that pressure by taxing, you know, the private sector and so on, to create the space for your public investment. And I just think, you know, this is kind of fairly straightforward. And what I recommend anybody, you know, listening to this is to read Stephanie Kelton's The Deficit Myth. Excellent book. Which actually explodes, you know, the myths and explains, you know, how the economy can work for in the interests of the many, not the few, as it were. And there's another good book by Bill Mitchell, and it's called Reclaiming the State. I think it's produced, I'm not sure if it's Pluto Press that produced that, but anyway, yeah, Reclaiming the State by Bill Mitchell. That or The Deficit Myth are books which are well worth reading. And I think it's important that, you know, people get up to speed to some extent on this, because, it, you know, if I think people have a better understanding of how the monetary system operates, then it prevents, you know, the media, it prevents politicians from pulling the wool over our eyes. And that's what they've been doing.
Yeah, I broadly agree with that. It's what he's expounding there is what's called modern monetary theory. And it's not mainstream economic theory in the universities and the City of London, but it's based on Keynes's general theory of employment, interest and money, which came out in 1936. And there really is a problem with people basically lacking fundamental economic education. So that everybody thinks they understand economics because they manage their own budget. And this is why you get away with the government saying we've maxed out the credit card, which of course the economy isn't based on credit cards. It doesn't run like that. Money is ultimately potentially creatable by the political authorities, but it's been farmed out to the private sector. So you end up borrowing, you bail the banks out like we did in 2008, and then we borrow the money back from those banks that we bailed out. Now, what you could have done at that stage is nationalise the banking system and do exactly what Chris Williams is suggesting there, which is the government then takes over the credit function completely.
Okay, so the book is Stephanie Kelton, K-E-L-T-O-N, and the title is The Deficit Myth, How to Build a Better Economy. Sounds pretty simple, and it's about the myth that we mustn't have a deficit. The other book he was mentioning there is Reclaiming the State by Bill Mitchell. But this is basic stuff, isn't it? But it's not pushed by the likes of economics correspondent Robert Peston and the rest of them in the London media, because as Ian Fraser, I think it was, said on this show many years ago, he said that those people, if they start stepping out of line, then they find there's no more stories for them.
Well, that's right. I mean, what you've got is two things. You've got the City of London, which dominates, you know, the business news on mainstream programs. You know, the city thinks this, and everybody's got to go, well, that's, they must know what they're doing. They wouldn't be so wealthy otherwise. And you've also got in economics departments, actually not so much in macroeconomic departments. If you actually go to academic economists like Simon Wren Lewis points out in his mainly macro blog, mainstream macroeconomists have always argued against austerity. Austerity is self-defeating. It doesn't, you know, Osborne lost the country's AAA credit rating through his austerity policy. You couldn't make it up, but that should have opened people's eyes to the fact that it's a con trick, because it is a con trick. Now, I don't think it's modern monetary theory. I mean, Wren Lewis is not a modern monetary theorist. He's got sympathy with it, but he tends to think, well, there are some constraints on money creation by governments. But the fact is that in Japan, for the last 30 or 40 years, the government has had to prop the economy up because there isn't any other choice. Now, when things get really iffy, then these more radical policies will suddenly begin to seem common sense.
My take on it is that we've got a City of London that is prepared to pull the plug on the economy anytime it feels suitable, and actually probably to make quite a lot of money when they do so.
Well, that's right. But then of course, the question becomes, can we afford the City of London if they're going to impoverish everybody for their own benefit?
Well, no, we can't. But then we're stuck with them, aren't we, for the time being?
For the time being,
anyway,
yes.
Prepare for war, says The Sun on Saturday. UK Army must get ready to fight the Russians and win in a potential World War III, says Britain's top general. In fact, this was widely reported right across the country. This is General Sir Patrick Sanders, the new army commander, says that Putin's bloodbath assault on Ukraine has rocked the foundations of global security, allegedly. So he vowed to forge an army that can beat Russia in battle, Martin.
Well, anybody who wants to take that seriously ought to have a look at the Reminiscences of the Future, which is Andrei Martynov's blog. He's a Russian based in the US. He's a military expert, really. I mean, if you think about it, what makes the head of the British Army think that they can take on the Russian armed forces? The only way that that could possibly happen is it's an adjunct to the US armed forces. But as Scott Ritter, who used to belong to the US armed forces, points out, NATO cannot win a conventional battle against Russia in Europe. Well, look, just can't.
Patrick Sanders' comments were, he didn't pop up on the television himself. General Sir Lord Dannett said it for him.
I know Patrick Sanders well, and he is being characteristically straightforward and open with the troops under his command, and he's looking around at the situation in Europe, situation between Russia and Ukraine, and is making the very reasonable deduction that we must be prepared to fight for our independence and our freedom, just as we've had to do in the past. Now, that's not to say that is definitely going to happen, far from it. But what he's really saying is that we must be prepared in every possible way to fight. And this acts as a very strong deterrent to Russia becoming more ambitious and pressing somewhere else along its border. If you think back before February the 24th, before Vladimir Putin attacked Ukraine, he was making all kinds of noises about wanting to roll the influence of NATO back, wanting to extend the influence of Russia. And by inference, he was talking about pressing maybe in the Baltic states, Estonia, Lithuania, Latvia, pushing on Poland and other countries like that. Now, that's not going to happen in the short to medium term for sure, because he's had a very bloody nose in the fight with Ukraine. But while he is still the Russian president, he will continue with this mantra of wanting to press and extend Russian influence. And we must be prepared to stop that. And the best way that we will stop that is being well-armed, well-trained, and have a forward presence to deter him being expansionist like that again. And that's what General Patrick was talking about.
General Patrick, he calls him, not General Stewart. But anyway, so that's General Lord Dannett. I just find it amazing that they're thinking about taking on Russia. I don't think we can do it. And anyway, why would we want to? There's nobody actually threatening Britain.
Well, that's right.
There's an element of
Although didn't they say they might nuke our cities or something?
Well, I mean, a nuclear war could easily take place as a result of what's happening.
Especially if we were to bring
the British Army won't be much help in that situation.
Especially if
will
we
it?
Were to bring American nuclear weapons and allow them to be put on British soil, or say,
well, I think more,
RAF Fairford or USAF yeah. Fairford well, in
more,
Gloucestershire,
more threatening, or Mildenhall, more threatening to the Russians is the short-range missiles being put into Poland and Romania, and they've basically said if you do that, that's potentially a casus belli for us. Just as if the Russians put missiles into Cuba, you can be pretty certain that any American government would say, right, well, we're not going to accept that.
The question
is, the Russians feel exactly the same.
How ready are the Brits to fight?
We've got 148 main battle tanks. You're not going to fight a war and win a war with 148 main battle tanks. That's frankly enough to equip two brigades, two small groups, whereas in the days of the Cold War, we fielded four armoured divisions. What's a division? About 25,000 to 30,000 soldiers. We had four divisions. We haven't got a single deployable division now. So if we want to be taken seriously and we want to have the influence that our politicians want us to have, and certainly the influence that their words suggest that they want us to have, we've got to have a greater investment in our land capability and get on with it pretty quickly. And also just bear in mind, we have been giving to Ukraine a lot of our anti-tank weapons, the NLAW anti-tank weapon, very effective, but we've given a huge proportion of our stock away. We've got to start restocking pretty quickly and expand our own capability. And General Sanders is right. This isn't a message to the government. He's just saying to the army, we've got to be prepared to do our job, and let's make sure we've got the tools to do the job with.
Well, they quite clearly haven't at the moment, Martin, have they?
No, and of course, what we're really talking about here is the British arms industry and the American arms industry should be given lots of new orders. And of course, these ex-generals are often on the boards of these companies because, and then we've got to build up the army, but there's no military strategy there. In actual fact, no fight with Russia on Russia's borders is winnable. Of course, it's not. The Russians are the local, locally.
They're not that local.
Well,
they are
local to the Ukraine. They're the next door country.
Yeah.
We are 1,000 miles Danik, at least away from it.
Danik there's talking about the Baltics. There was quite a big development this week in the Baltics. I wonder if maybe the Brits were urging it along. NATO certainly must have been when the Lithuanians decided that the enclave of Kaliningrad was no longer going to be allowed to transport energy and minerals by road or rail through Lithuania into Kaliningrad. So this, we're going to hear a report now from Channel 4 News, Janie Keith, on this Kaliningrad thing. Do you want to say anything before we hear the report, Martin? Because this is an important spot, isn't it?
Well, it is, yeah. I mean, obviously, it used to be East Prussia, was, you know, seceded to the Soviet Union at the end of World War II and has now got a largely Russian-speaking population of just over 1 million, I think, in there. And it's a major military base for the Russian armed forces.
And particularly the Navy in the Baltic. Anyway, yeah. Let's have a listen to the Channel 4 News report now.
Supply route, coal and metals to this enclave by the Baltic Sea is by train, but that has hit the buffers thanks to EU sanctions over Moscow's invasion of Ukraine. Kaliningrad might be 800 miles from Moscow, but it's strategically important. The Baltic Fleet is headquartered there. But with no land border, Russia has sent goods by rail and road through Lithuania. Now the EU member has refused to allow some Russian goods to pass, Moscow will have to try to send them by sea. In Kaliningrad today, one of Putin's top security officials, Nikolai Petrushev, accused Lithuania of bringing in an illegal blockade at the suggestion of the West and said Moscow would retaliate.
This example shows that you cannot trust either verbal statements by the West or written ones. Russia will certainly respond to such hostile actions. Appropriate measures are being worked out between departments and will be taken in the near future. Their consequences will have a serious negative impact on the population of Lithuania.
Exactly what the consequences might be, economic or military, Russia didn't say. But bear in mind, Lithuania is a member of NATO, and any military action would draw a response from the alliance as a whole. Lithuania says it's ironic Russia is accusing the West of violating international law. The EU's ambassador, summoned to the Russian Foreign Ministry so the Kremlin could complain, said he'd asked Moscow to remain calm and resolve the issue diplomatically.
And here I had the opportunity to make clear the EU position that there is no such thing as a banning of transit, there's no such thing as a blockade. I appealed to the Russian side to remain cool-headed, not to escalate.
Meanwhile, in Ukraine, Russia is escalating its assault in the east. The city of Severodonetsk now feels like the epicenter of the fighting. Russian forces have captured almost all of the city. And in a grim echo of the siege of the Azovstal steelworks in Mariupol, they've pushed Ukrainian soldiers and hundreds of civilians back to this chemical factory. These are some of the evacuees from the east, people leaving the city of Slovyansk after fighting intensified. Emma says it was a very frightening situation, and she's leaving her disabled husband behind, where there's no power or water and no bread. Sophia says fighting was raging, children were scared. You never knew when a shell might hit your house, she says. So they fled. After nearly 4 long months of fighting, the people of Ukraine are exhausted. But the Russian president's appetite for war is not. Vladimir Putin today vowed to strengthen his armed forces by the end of the year.
Jane Deeth reporting.
That's the Channel 4 news report on Kaliningrad, Martin. I mean, this is, sounds to me, I would imagine that the Russians can still bring equipment, food, etc. in there by air as well as by sea. But certainly now Lithuania and NATO are denying the use of rail and road to them.
Yeah, well, of course, Lithuania could then be blockaded on the Russian side where they're not going to let anything go in. And they could blockade them from the seaside as well.
Is this what NATO wants, do you think?
Well, if the danger of this is that there is what you might call unplanned escalation. The Lithuanians are almost like wag the dog situation. They've got a very hostile policy towards the Russians, but them doing that, you see, the Latvians and the Estonians haven't joined in this, the Poles haven't joined in it, and they're all potentially implicated. The Lithuanians decided that they were going to kick out the Chinese ambassador some while ago, and of course the problem with all of this is that they may then precipitate a confrontation with the Russians, which then drags NATO into a confrontation with the Russians, which of course is quite possible in the circumstances we're in. Both sides are daggers drawn, and the slightest miscalculation by either side can lead to disaster.
Well, it reminds me a bit of 1948-1949 with the Berlin airlift, because that was what led to the creation of the Berlin Wall. The idea that at that point, it was the Soviet Union that denied the Americans and the British and other European states the right to drive or take trains into Berlin. I think actually maybe there was a train, but I'm not quite sure. But anyway, that led to all the equipment and people going backwards and forwards between Western Europe and West Berlin, having to do it by aircraft for best part of a year, I think it was. Yes, 1948, 1949.
Yes, and of course the Russians could have shot down those aircraft and then off you'd go, but obviously they didn't.
This was the opening shot of the Cold War.
Well, the Cold War had been brewing from before.
But it was, this is where it starts to, sort of solidify, if you want. The ice starts to solidify. But this seems to me to be an equivalent kind of a situation now.
We're in a very, very dangerous situation. Anybody who's read books like A.J.P. Taylor's The Struggle for Mastery in Europe or, the situation is very similar to the run-up to World War One. Whatever people may think.
What similarities do you draw, direct similarities?
The direct similarities are that you've got mobilised public opinion on both sides. The Russians think they're in the right here. I mean, lots of people in the West don't think they are, but they don't see it like that. And they've got a very different information environment than the one we've got. So I've mentioned this before about things like basic information about what happened at the Maidan Square in 2014 when the demonstrators were all shot down. There's been a court case in Kyiv which came out in 2018. It was quite clear that was a NATO death squad. Now, the Russians are well aware of this. They see pictures of refugees from Donetsk and Luhansk coming into Russia, telling terrible tales of the atrocities by the Ukrainian military, And the way it's been presented in the West is that the Russians are doing all the terrible stuff, including, for example, the claim that they were raping babies.
It'd be the opposite on the other side, won't it?
Well, I mean, in Yugoslavia, when I was an aid worker, people realised that this was complicated. Yeah. The Serbs were saying this, the Croats were saying that, the Bosnians were saying something else. People realised that it was messy.
Whereas in what, that clutter, I suppose, in that clutter, it's much easier to sort of bamboozle people with propaganda when there's lots of different hit-miss messages.
But people recognised that Yugoslavia was a complex situation, because it was. And the Ukraine is a complex situation as well. It's not just the Russians for some unknown reason have decided to chuck their weight about. The Donbass republics voted to secede from the Ukraine in 2014 by votes of over 80%, and they were then attacked by the Kiev regime, and 14,000 people ended up dead. Now, if Britain was watching 14,000 British-speaking people being massacred on the other side of the Channel by the French, they would feel that they might have to intervene. Any Russian government would be under pressure to intervene in those circumstances.
And they have been, haven't they? Anyway, I think we covered the World Economic Forum last week and the week before, and particularly speeches there and things organised by Viktor Pinchuk, who's this Ukrainian, joint Ukrainian-Israeli citizen oligarch and very powerful figure for many years in Ukraine, somebody who's certainly the evidence is was behind one of the main people behind the coup back in 2014, Pinchuk, down at the World Economic Forum. But Martin, that isn't the only economic forum, is it? They have also something called the St. Petersburg International Economic Forum too now.
Well, that's right, and that's just taken place in St. Petersburg.
So let's have a listen to, as our final item before the break, is President Putin opening the non-NATO, non-G7 version of the World Economic Forum.
It is the nature of current spasms of Russophobia in the West and crass sanctions against Russia. Crass, and I would say thoughtless. Their numbers, as well as the speed of stamping, are unprecedented. The calculation was very clear. Snarling with haste attack the Russian economy by destroying business chains, forcibly withdrawing Western companies from the Russian market, freezing domestic assets to hit industry, finance, and people's living standards. We will normalize the economic situation step by step. Initially, financial markets, the banking system, and the trading networks were stabilized. Then we began to saturate the economy with liquidity and working capital to preserve the sustainability of enterprises and companies, employment and jobs. Dark forecasts about the prospects of the Russian economy, which had been sounded in early spring, did not come true. At the same time, it is clear why this propaganda campaign was fanned, where all these hexes came from, about the dollar for 200 rubles and the collapse of our economy as a whole. All this was and remains an instrument of information war, a vector of psychological impact on Russian society, on domestic business circles.
So that's Vladimir Putin there, translated, but speaking at the St. Petersburg International Economic Forum this week, Martin. He's really explaining, well, there was an unprecedented series of rubber stamps on an amazing array of sanctions immediately after the invasion of Ukraine, which he, of course, would not call it an invasion. He'd call it a special military operation or intervention in the civil war in Ukraine. But actually, the effect of it has been pretty much nothing. They made a few changes in Russia. Now they're fine.
Well, any shock requires, there'll be some costs associated with it. But of course, the Russians have been under sanctions since 2014, at the very beginning of the crisis. And as a result of that, they've had all these years to adapt to those sanctions. So, for example, in 2014, they were still buying a lot of food products from Western countries. And they just stopped doing it and got their own agriculture up to speed to provide all the food they need and to become a major food exporter. They've done that in that period. Yeah, they weren't a major food exporter before. Now they are. And the Russian market is now closed to Western European and East European farmers. But that's never going to, you know, that's that. That's the end of that market. And the Russia is a very big country with large resources. And if they're properly organized, they are probably one of the few countries in the world that could be absolutely self-sufficient. And of course, they also supply loads of really crucial commodities, rare earths, titanium, uranium, gas to make fertilizer. The European economy is integrated with the Russian economy because it's geography. They're much closer to us than the United States or the Chinese. So inevitably, you know, naturally, there would be more integration in those economies.
Okay, so I think for me, the big thing of this week is the sealing off of Kaliningrad. How do you think that's going to go? Is it going to be like a year like the Berlin airlift was and
I think the way the Russians will probably respond to this is that they will just turn the pain dial up on the Lithuanians. How much unemployment do you want, Lithuania? And this already happened. You see, people who work on the railways in Lithuania, where they're not going to take any more of this Russian stuff, they've had to sack them because there's no trains to run. So they've cancelled the trains, but now they've got to sack the rail workers.
I believe in God, the Father Almighty, maker of heaven and earth, and in Jesus Christ, his only Son, our Lord, who was conceived by the Holy Ghost, born of the Virgin Mary, suffered under Pontius Pilate, was crucified, dead, and buried. The third day he rose again from the dead. He ascended into heaven, and sitteth on the right hand of God the Father Almighty. From thence he shall come to judge the quick and the dead. I believe in the Holy Ghost, the Holy Catholic Church, the communion of saints, the forgiveness of sins, the resurrection of the body, and the life everlasting. Amen.
We've had an extraordinary programme today with the past, present and future by looking at the English Civil War and this investigation I've done into the English Civil War in part one. Part two is a kind of normal show looking at news events of the week. But now joining me on the line from Bath is Martin Whittock, and he's the author of a recent article in the Tablet called The Day of the Lord, and also a book called The End Times Again. And what he's been doing is looking at this whole idea of the end of the world. Martin, can you hear me?
I can. Hopefully you can hear me.
Yes, I can hear you fine, Martin. So the first question has got to be, I think what we'll do in a little bit later is we'll look at some of how this might relate to current events or not, has got to be the first question, how you became interested in these end time beliefs yourself as a writer.
Well, I was a teenager of the 1970s, so that gives you some idea of my age. I was 63. And at that time, I came across books that were being published, mostly from the States, actually, influencing quite a few people within the particular Christian circles that I was moving in, such as The Late Great Planet Earth by Hal Lindsey. And quite a few people of the 70s will nod when they hear that, if they were in evangelical churches or Pentecostal churches in the 70s, because it was quite a big book. It wasn't a very big book, but the book was big in terms of its effect, if you see what I mean. And what Lindsey did was he claimed to be able to interpret biblical prophecy, to explain the world in which we were living, and indeed to point forward to the imminent second coming of Christ. So that was quite a kind of an attention-grabbing experience as a 16, 17-year-old. And I can remember discussing it with a lot of people at the time. And that got me just interested in the whole issue of the end times. And then I went to university. I was at Bristol and I read politics. I came across 17th century radicals like the Diggers and Quakers and the Fifth Monarchy men. And I became to realise that they were saying exactly the same things with different targets in the 17th century, in the 1640s, 1650s, to what Hal Lindsey was pointing at. Only whereas Lindsey was talking about the Arab states and the European Union, EEC, as it was. So they were talking about the papacy. They were talking about Charles I. And I began to think, we've been here before. And I then got very interested in the whole history of end times teaching, end times beliefs. And it kind of all rolled on from there.
What about your own faith?
Well, I'm a Christian. I happen to be a licensed lay minister in the Church of England. I attend a church that would probably be described as an evangelical church. So obviously we have quite a lot of information that connects us with other evangelical churches, you know, around the world. So we know quite a lot what's going on in America, although the evangelical church in the UK is very different to the evangelical church in the USA. But that's my sort of background. I'm a Christian. I would be within an evangelical church, licensed lay minister in the Church of England. I believe that there will come a time when the present order of things will be brought together. In other words, I believe there is a second coming, but I actually believe that the church's track record on predicting it and deciding when it would be and interpreting it is pretty woeful. And I think there's lots of scriptural reasons why we shouldn't be doing it. But I'm very much aware that many of my fellow Christians, sisters and brothers, do it a great deal. And that's what got me to thinking about maybe we should be thinking about this a lot more carefully than sometimes, in my opinion, we do.
Yeah, right. Well, Martin, we've got the two Martins here, but Martin Whittock, I'm reminded of what Martin Summers, the other guest we've got here, who's on here every week. And Martin is always predicting, you're always predicting a financial disaster, financial crash. And it sounds like a similar, almost a sort of parallel with what Christians in the counterculture are constantly saying, oh, it's the second coming of Christ coming along and the end of the world.
Except we have had a crash in 2008, and there was one in 1929.
No, 2008 was just a minute, please, because it was not a crash. It wasn't like 1929 when the stock market crashed. It was a bailout. So there was a crash was about to happen, and a fantastic amount of money was made up out of nowhere and injected into the banking system in order to try and it didn't. If you look at the stock market figures, it wasn't actually a crash. It was a bailout to avoid a crash.
Yes, but loads of people lost their jobs and their houses and their savings.
Now have a potential, Martin Summers, for an enormous crash, don't we, actually?
We do, yes. And, of course, that's to do with economic analysis. Although, of course, that doesn't mean that, if you've got an apocalyptic approach, that could be part of an apocalyptic breakdown.
We've heard
breakdown,
from Martin Whittock about the Church of England predicting the end of the world. But what about the Bank of England predicting the crash? Can they do it?
Well, the problem with not predicting, I mean, the Queen famously said, you know, why didn't anybody predict this when she went to the London School of Economics? And the reason being that the mainstream economists had, were basically barking up the wrong tree, that their analysis was rubbish. That's why they didn't predict it.
Anyway.
They were just not good enough.
Martin Whittock, drilling into the actual theology of this a little bit, you talk about the connection between the ascension with the promise of the return of Christ.
Yeah, yeah. First thing I should say, the Church of England definitely doesn't predict the end of the world. It's one of those groups which would say that, we don't know when Christ will return, though we believe he will. But I have to say, many Christians, probably within the Church of England and within other churches, do predict and do speculate. But I thought I'd better say that in case anybody thinks that... The Archbishop of Canterbury suddenly changed his policy on this. He would definitely believe in the second coming, but he would definitely not be one, giving dates and places and so on. But yeah, I mean, basically, the Christian faith, the New Testament Christian faith, is that Christ has an earthly ministry. God comes in the form of his son, Jesus. He has an earthly ministry for somewhere in the region of 33 years. Christians, myself included, of course, believe that he died and was raised and was then taken back to heaven in the ascension with the promise that he would one day return. So if you like, that is kind of the foundational bedrock of Christian belief. But the debate, of course, is when? Is it now? Is it tomorrow? Is it soon? And you can imagine over 2,000 years, that has started quite a conversation. And we're actually told in the scriptures, in the Gospel of Matthew, for example, and in the Acts of the Apostles, that people do not know the day or the hour. So Christians are warned not to speculate. It'll happen, but you don't know when. But you can imagine that people tend to move into that apparent vacuum of question of when will it be, when will it be, when will it be, and they come up with answers. And again, you then begin that track record of speculation, which is starting for the Roman Empire, running right the way today. Huge numbers of mainline US Christians believe, for example, living in the last days. So it's a 2,000 year period of speculation, which I would say is problematic. We might want in a minute just look at some of the high and low points of that. But certainly for 2,000 years, many Christians, not all, have tried to answer the question when by saying, well, I think it's now, I think it's now, I think it's tomorrow, I think it's next year, and so on.
I would say big problem. Don't do that. But it's very, very prevalent.
Yeah, but I mean, there is this tendency of human beings to be a bit paranoid, isn't there? The idea that's, oh God, you know, something dreadful is about to happen. In fact, that's quite a, you know, maybe you could say with the mental health thing as it is, an increasing thing that people do is they are sort of, you know, almost predicting doom all the time with a very negative sort of point of view of the world. But I think to really get started with this, Martin, what we need to do is you need to say exactly what the Bible does say. What are those, you know, specific things?
Okay, well, the scripture talks about Christ will return. And then scattered across scripture, there are descriptions about events of the end times. There are talks about, you know, somebody called like an antichrist or somebody that will arise and, you know, will oppose God in the last days. There's some debate about that because there isn't just one single figure of the antichrist in scripture. But then you have, for example, the huge cosmic vision of Revelation, the book of Revelation, which is full of these extraordinary images about things that will finally come to pass to bring the present age to a close. And you either read that as powerful symbolic language that it will happen sometime, but these are the kinds of things that we're to understand from this, or you take those as programs. Now, some Christians take those as programs, so they're literally looking down and they're saying, well, you know, it talks about these certain judgments or these certain events, and they tend to read those programmatically. I tend to not read them in that sort of chronological programmatic sense, but a lot of Christians do. And when you do that, you then start to look for signs that are identifying that you're at that point in the timeline.
Well, people certainly have been doing that. And I'd just like to play you a clip from a film called Naked. I'm not sure if you're familiar with it. Mike Leigh film. Who's a, you know, well-known British director, but it's a film of his that I didn't know. And this is a monologue spoken by the character Johnny, who's played by David Thewlis in Naked. And this is way back in 1993. So I think we should have a listen to that. And this is his kind of rant, really, quoting from the book of Revelation and sort of tying it into some of the things that we're seeing developing in the world right now. So let's have a listen to that, and then we'll get your comments on it, Martin.
Has nobody not told you, Brian, that you've got this kind of gleeful preoccupation with the future? I wouldn't even mind, but you don't even have a future. I don't have a future. Nobody has a future. The party's over. Take a look around you, man. It's all breaking up. Are you not familiar with the book of Revelations of St. John, the final book of the Bible, prophesying the apocalypse?
Yes, as it happens, I'm familiar with all the books of the Bible.
I'm very happy for you. He forced everyone to receive a mark on his right hand or on his forehead so that no one shall be able to buy or sell unless he has the mark, which is the name of the beast or the number of his name, and the number of the beast is 666.
I know about it.
Great.
I know about Nostradamus. Nostradamus talked about three brothers. Now, did he mean the Kennedy brothers, or was he talking about three bits of the Soviet Union? See? You just can't tell.
Nostradamus? I'm not talking about Nostradamus, a mother shipped and a Russell Grant, a mystic Meg. I'm talking about the Holy Book. What can such a specific prophecy mean? What is the mark? Well, the mark, Brian, is the barcode, the ubiquitous barcode that you'll find on every bog roll and every packet of Johnny's and every poxy pork pie. And every barcode is divided into two parts by three markers. And those three markers are always represented by the number 666. Now, what does it say? No one shall be able to buy or sell without that mark. And now, what they're planning to do in order to eradicate all credit card fraud and in order to precipitate a totally cashless society, what they're planning to do, what they've already tested on the American troops, they're going to subcutaneously laser tattoo that mark onto your right hand or onto your forehead. They're going to replace plastic with flesh. Fact. In the same book of Revelations, when the seven seals are broken open on the day of judgment and the seven angels blow the trumpets, when the third angel blows her bugle, wormwood will fall from the sky. Wormwood will poison a third part of all the waters and a third part of all the land, and many, many, many people will die. Now, do you know what the Russian translation for wormwood is?
No.
Chernobyl. Another fact. Do you want me to go on? The end of the world is nigh, Bride. The game is up.
So that's the actor David Thewlis, who actually won, I think it's at Cannes, the Best Actor Award for his performance in Mike Leigh's film Naked, which was produced in released in 1993. His character there is Johnny. I'm joined on the line by the author Martin Whittock from Bath. Now, Martin, what do you make of that? Because there's quite a lot of people there. I mean, certainly friends of mine would say, well, actually, this Mark of the Beast is getting pretty sinister. This idea of sort of digital money, and particularly one which is associated with, you know, you personally, where you just go bip to buy something. He's pointing out there that the barcode contains, every barcode contains these three sixes. It's starting to look a little bit sinister.
Well, they certainly might be right. The only problem is, for 2,000 years, believers have been looking at exactly the same scriptures and applying them equally sincerely to what they thought were equally concrete things and getting it wrong. So, for example, the words, the title Nero Caesar, persecutor of the church at the time of the writing of the book of Revelation, the numerical value of his name when transliterated is 666. So in other words, it's quite likely that when John was writing Revelations, he had Nero Caesar in mind and was saying, basically, in life, it's about whether you go God's way or whether you go the world's way. If you go the world's way, the world is always calling for your complete allegiance, your complete loyalty. If you go God's way, he's calling for your complete allegiance, your complete loyalty. Basically, when push comes to shove, John's saying, you've got to make a choice. So it may well be that in the fullness of time, for all I know, that maybe the barcode, the buying and selling, etc., may well be the way in which this plays out. This is realised.
I mean, it does make you wonder about money. Money being very, very significant. I mean, it's almost like a sort of religion. You know, I see at Cabot Circus here in Bristol. I'm sure you've been in there too. It almost looks like a sort of temple to money. And of course, Jesus did throw the money. This is the only time that he used force in his ministry, was throwing the money changers out of the temple.
Yeah. That's true. I mean, the other thing I would say was is that when John wrote that, you know, sometime in the second half of the first century, people that received that, and we know from other evidence, clearly thought they understood it straight away. So I think that's the problem, that often we almost assume that these kind of things arrived on people's inboxes, as it were, in the first century, and they all looked at it and said, well, I haven't got a clue what this is all about. I haven't got a clue. Let's wait for 2,000 years till credit cards come along. Well, actually, at the time, lots of people thought they did understand it and did explain it. And I think one of the challenges is that I think we have to look for the fundamental message of these scriptures rather than the nitty-gritty program, because as I say, for 2,000 years people looked at, for example, 666, and they identified it with particular people, particular circumstances, and clearly they were wrong. So I can't possibly say that it's not credit cards and so on. What I can say is caution, because for 2,000 years we have got it wrong. And the most fundamental issue is what John would wanted people to know is, whose side are you on? Are you on God's side, or you're on the world side? And that, I think, is the fundamental question.
Well, one of the things I think we could probably both agree you do need to do is to look at whether lots of different prophecies are all lining up at the same time. And if they start to do that, then, you know, maybe to pay a little bit more attention to the book of Revelation, get that old Bible dusted off. I mean, I think we have to admit, I'm sure you know, that there were quite a lot of attempts historically to remove the book of Revelation from the Bible in, you know, these various councils that were held in the Orthodox Church days. There's also this thing of the falling away of faith, and we do seem to be seeing that even within the leadership of the church. I mean, although they will maybe profess their faith, there's also, I remember this article from the Times from the 1970s saying something like 65-70% of vicars and ordained ministers in the Church of England didn't believe in God, if you actually sort of try to, you know, actually pin them down. So they see it, like I suppose many journalists do, just as a career rather than something that they really believe in.
Without a doubt, one can see things mounting in certain areas, and yet there's always a danger that you see it from your particular perspective. So, for example, that's a very Western perspective, and it obviously causes me concern as well, the falling away of faith. But if we're having this conversation in South America or in Southern Africa, for example, or in parts of the United States, we would say, well, there isn't the same kind of massive falling away of faith. You know, there are still hundreds of thousands of people going to church, believing and so on. So the only caution I would then interject in that is, not that I'm blasé about this, but there is a danger of seeing it only from your point of view. By yours, I don't mean yours, I mean ours, mine, in this particular context. You know what I mean? And the danger is, one looks around where one is in the UK in 2022 and says, well, this is happening. This must be what John was writing about. And yet, to be frank about it, it, that might not be the experience of Christians in, let's say, Korea or Singapore, for example, or wherever. And I think one has to look at the global picture. And I think that's the challenge. And I think the other challenge is that there have been lots of other periods of history where things have been really, really bad. I mean, if you had been, let's say, a French peasant in 1400 and the English armies had just rampaged through your village again, burnt everything down, following it by crop failure, you know, following it by disease which always follow in the wake of armies. The generation after the Black Death had taken away at least a third, perhaps, or a half of the entire European population, which makes COVID look, you know, bad as it is, really, really small in comparison, then I think you'd have had a very real reason for looking at your context and saying this clearly is famine, death, war, etc. And you'd have been wrong. So it doesn't mean to say people saying it now are going to be wrong, but boy, you've got to be careful, because just because things are happening in a certain way now does not mean it is necessarily imminent, because there have been times in the past where things will have looked pretty imminent and they weren't.
Yeah. So, but at some point, of course, it will happen.
So
you have to get that balance right. Now, you also talk about modern Russia a bit, don't you? So some of the radicalized politics there are also, you know, there are trends in end times thinking over in Russia too.
Yes, that's absolutely right. I mean, as a Christian, I would say there is a balance between being ready every day, every moment. That's the challenge, but not being obsessed with what have you, because we often get it wrong. Okay, but we need to be ready as Christians, because that's what scriptural faith says to be ready to give an account at any time.
Isn't that the idea that you've got to have your lamps filled with oil and ready for the wedding?
That's right. Yeah. I mean, the context is not that you go through your life full of fear, but that you think, well, at any time, life could end. And to be blunt about it, at any time, any of our lives could end, you know, second coming or just the natural order of things. So you could be run over
by a bus, as they say.
Yeah, absolutely. So to be ready at any time, I think that is an absolutely perfectly reasonable point to have. The danger is when you apply it, as I say, to politics in such a confident way. So, for example, in Russia at the moment, we've got apocalyptic nationalists saying it's the Antichrist West we're against, and therefore that means that if it does turn to nuclear war, well, that's okay, because we're on the right side. And you're thinking, hey, wait a minute, guys, can we just back up on this just a little bit? Because actually, in the States, you've also got people saying very similar things. We're convinced that America first, make America great again under Trump, you know, God's on our side.
Well, I can also remember the Iraqis talking about the devil bush, and I must admit, yes, I can see what they exactly meant, you know, at the time of this illegal war being launched.
Yeah, exactly. And so what I'm really saying is, I think there's a danger that this can become weaponized and hijacked by people and then used to justify very, very radicalized situations. So I can remember people saying in the 1980s, 1980s, saying, oh yeah, we shouldn't work for nuclear disarmament because the world's going to end anyway. I hear people saying things now like, oh, we shouldn't be worrying about climate change because the world's going to end anyway. And that's the point at which I would say, no, that is not the position to take at all. You know, we're called to live as if we're going to live forever, you know, because you never know when it's going to be, but it might be tomorrow you die. We're called to live responsibly for the world as if it was going to go on for 10,000 years, but it could end tomorrow. And what worries me is when it becomes a reason in people's arguments for actually either disengaging with the dangers and worries of the world, and that is really happening at the moment, or becomes a way by which radicalized violent nationalism can be justified. So, you know, I'll nuke you because God's on my side, Russia. Alternatively, I'll nuke you because God's on my side, America. And I'm thinking, whoa, I don't think that's how it works at all, guys. And I don't think you can use the second coming as a way to radicalize your politics, because fundamentally we are following a servant messiah who gave his life for people and who didn't impose himself on others. And I think that since the Cold War, end times thinking, particularly in the West, but now increasingly in Russia, have become radicalized to justify extreme right-wing politics. And that gives me real cause for concern.
Yeah, particularly with the Jewish right, the Zionists. I interviewed David Livingstone on this program. He's the author of Transhumanism, The History of a Dangerous Idea, and also a book called The Dying God, which looks at a lot of this sort of thing. And he was suggesting that actually there is a faction within the far right in Israel which thinks it's a good idea to have a war because that will bring about the Messiah coming to save them. I mean, this kind of idea is potentially quite dangerous, isn't it, Martin?
I've come across this. I mean, we're talking about a minority here, but we're talking about a very extreme minority, sometimes called the temple builders, where we find extreme US evangelicals and some people within the extreme right of the Zionist movement coming together and actually talking about things like blowing up the Temple Mount, for example, destroying the Al-Aqsa Mosque, for example. And you're thinking this will actually cause an utter catastrophe, a conflagration. Why are they doing this? Because these extremists, and we must stress this is a small minority of extremists, are doing it because they think they can speed up the timetable. They can speed up the timeline. They can move things forward. And that's very, very dangerous. And it's fair to say, for example, that when President Trump made statements that he made about recognizing Israeli control of the Golan Heights, about moving the US embassy to Jerusalem. I mean, regardless of what people think about this, the interesting thing was he said, I'm not doing this for Jewish Christians. Sorry, beg your pardon. I'm not doing this for US Jews. Sorry. I'm not doing this for Jews in the United States. I'm doing this for US evangelicals. So effectively, he was doing this because he was talking to a key area of his base, because something like about, 81% of white US evangelicals voted for Trump. So these things can have very, very dangerous effects, with people thinking they can speed up the timetable. They can move the timeline along. And at that point, you begin to say, I think we are very, very dangerous territory. And I'm talking here about, fellow believers. But you can find the same thing in
Well, that's, areas. I mean, that's particularly dodgy for a nuclear-armed state in denial. Yeah, right. But then there's a secular kind of version of this that I've come across also in interviews with David Livingstone, talking about these group called the Accelerationists. And these are basically Nietzschean philosophers, right, who believe that this is a great thing, that we need to prove the non-existence of God by having a horrific war in the Middle East or elsewhere, a third world war, and basically daring God to appear. And they'll say, well, look, you people are just cowards. You believe in God because you're cowardly and you can't face up to your own mortality, and you use the idea of God to kind of answer questions that you can't be bothered to really answer, and so we're going to prove that there is no God by having a massive war, and your God is not going to come to help you.
That's not very helpful, is it, really? And that kind of regards humanity as being collateral damage in a philosophical argument. And I just find that absolutely astonishing. But you can find that kind of attitude a little bit reflected in a lot of extreme eschatological positions, where effectively the human race are regarded as collateral damage in order to make your point. And I just don't think God views it that way. I mean, this is my point of view. I just don't think when we read things in the Gospels like, God so loved the world that he gave his only son, that I don't think that kind of God views humanity as collateral damage, in order to settle an argument. And I think whether it's done in a secular sense or a religious sense, and we can find aspects of this, within Islam, as well as with extreme aspects of Judaism and within extreme aspects of Christianity. When we come across these things, I think we have to call it out and challenge it and say, actually, you're actually undermining the fundamental tenets of what your religious faith is about.
Well, yeah, I think George Bush and Tony Blair did a pretty good job about that, but sort of waving a Christian flag, both of them professing Christians, and then starting an illegal war like they did. But look, we've mentioned the book of Revelation, we've touched on that, but what are the other texts in the Bible where the end of the world is discussed? So anyway, we need to try and pin down this stuff, and obviously the Bible's the place to start.
Yeah. Well, within the Gospels, Jesus talks about his return, but he's not as highly specific as sometimes people claim. Within Matthew 24, for example, the disciples come out from the temple and say, amazing places, isn't it? And Jesus says, there'll come a time when not one brick will be, one stone will be upon another. And then there appears the rest of chapter 24, it wasn't a chapter in the original, that's a later subdivision, but that's not an issue. Chapter 24, Jesus then talks about this. And Christians traditionally read that as being Jesus talking about the signs that will lead up to his second coming. But I would argue, if you look at it very, very carefully, Matthew 24, Jesus is actually answering two questions that effectively the disciples say to him, when is this temple going to be trashed? And when are you going to come back? And Jesus, if you go through Matthew 24 very, very carefully, you can actually chart, in my opinion, that he actually gives them signs that says, well, there's going to be a time when this temple is going to be trashed. Effectively, he's looking forward to AD 70 and that event that will happen there when the Romans do this. But on the other hand, he's saying things like, but the end times, no one knows that end time. And it causes all sorts of confusion to people's minds when they read it as one answer, because Jesus says things like, this generation will see all this happen. Well, clearly, that generation didn't see all that happen, but they did see the Jerusalem temple destroyed. And I think if you read Matthew 24 as two answers to two questions, Jesus says political Judaism in the first century is going to take on Rome and it's going to end in a catastrophe. But actually, beyond that, there will come a time when I will return. And actually, about that, I'm not going to say a great deal at all, other than that it will happen. And I think a Christian mistake has been to put those two together. And then you get into things like, well, wars and rumors of wars. What is it? This war? Is it that war? Earthquakes in diverse places? Is it this one or that one? Something terrible is going to happen. In the Holy of Holies. Is that going to happen in Jerusalem today? No, it's not. That stuff happened in the first century. Jesus was warning people where political nationalist Judaism was going to go, tragically, if it took on Rome. But alongside that, he's saying, but actually, alongside that catastrophe, there will be a time when I will return. So that's a key point, and I would say Christians have often read that wrongly. There are lots of other references, for example, within the letters, but it's never a major focus along the idea that there will come a time of Christ's return, that we don't know when he'll come, that there'll be that the elements will be transformed, that there'll be a new heaven and a new earth. That's actually from Revelation.
Yeah.
But we find hints of that. But what we don't find is we don't find the kind of program which you then often find in books. You can buy books and they'll tell you, it'll be this, followed by that, followed by this, followed by that, followed by this. And it looks highly programmatic.
Well, that you can definitely find in Revelation. Revelation is most definitely a sort of succession of events. Yes. But what about, this is, in a way, an even more important question, because I know, the book of Isaiah, which is one of my favourite books, there is all sorts of stuff in there predicting the arrival of Jesus. But what about the Old Testament for Jews as well? Where is the reference to the actual end of it all?
That's absolutely true, because Christianity inherited from Judaism a concept of the day of the Lord. And basically, Christianity is, if you like, a linear religion, by which I mean Christians, as Jews, as Muslims too, believe that history is linear, that effectively it moves through a cycle, it comes to a completion. And clearly within the Old Testament, there is this profound belief that there will come a time when this imperfect world will be judged, it will be transformed, that God will make things right, he will declare on the side of the poor and the oppressed and so on. He will take on the evil and badness of the world. And this is often described as the day of the Lord. And you'll find that scattered across the prophets with the extraordinary prophetic language about transformation, about God coming to live with people, about the wicked having to answer for their wickedness and God's people being justified. But again, if you read that as powerful prophetic language, I think that's one thing. But if you read that as programmatic language, by which you sit down and say, well, is that event causing that one? Is that event causing that one? I think it's failed to understand apocalyptic scripture. That apocalyptic scripture is, in a sense, it's a bit like poetry. It's real. It's vibrant. It matters. But it's not a scientific textbook. And I think very often we read prophetic writing in a literalistic sense when that's not what prophetic writing is about. That doesn't mean to say it's not going to happen, but to read it as if you were reading a scientific textbook, well, I'll do now, or something from IKEA, well, I'll do this, then I'll do that, then I'll follow that, then programmatically lead to that, I think is a mistake. And I think that's one of our problems. It's there, it's powerful, but it's not a programmatic timetable. in my opinion.
Okay, well, a lot of people point to the Book of Daniel, don't they, and say that actually Daniel is, I mean, he's a very lovable character, obviously, and it's a terrific book as well, particularly the Catholic version, which is rather cheekily in the Reformation. The Protestants tore out the little best bit at the very end of Daniel. What do you make of what Daniel's spelling out there for Jews and Christians and Muslims too, obviously?
Yeah, quite. I mean, basically, Daniel 2 has these amazing, amazing prophecies, which, I mean, boil down to the fact that there are empires of the world, that there are kingdoms that rise and fall. They think they're powerful. They think they're going to last forever.
Well, one can't help but think about the British Empire or the American Empire or the Roman Empire. I mean, the Greeks, etc.
Exactly. So, for example, he talks about, you know, four beasts or four empires that will rise, and he describes them in extraordinary language. And the debate is, you know, is he talking about specific empires that ran up to his own day? Is he talking about something that's about to happen very soon? Or is he looking forward to a future event when certain empires will reach their final climactic end, and then God will effectively judge in favour of his people? Now, scholars are still debating exactly what Daniel is about, and Daniel is very, very powerful. But I think the danger again comes with Daniel when you start to actually see it as being a program that you can actually kind of map out. And in the 17th century, you know, you could have grabbed somebody in 1650 and said, "What's the Book of Daniel about?" And then they said, "Oh, well, that empire's this one, that empire's that one, that empire's this one, and the little horn of Daniel 7 that speaks, you know, terrible words of blasphemy, that is Charles the First. The little horns of doom and downfall, for example, was written by Mary Carey, I believe it was, in about sort of 1651. And she says that was Charles I. That was Charles I. Well, she was wrong. And I think, again, what we need to look for. And then he said it was Cromwell, because Cromwell was at one point a leading light. And then in the end, he lets them all down, in their opinion. So, again, Daniel talks about this succession. But I think what we need to look at is the principles of Daniel. What's he fundamentally talking about? He's saying that people that go God's way will find themselves at odds with the world. But don't be frightened, because ultimately God will decide in your favour. Now, some people might say, well, that's not being specific enough, Martin. All I would say is, when people get really specific, they get the mistakes that we've made in the past.
Right. Also, I mean, you're talking there about the English Civil War. We were spent most of the first hour talking about the English Civil War, about the rivalry between Cromwell and Charles the First. This was such an important part of history. I mean, not just for us here in the southwest of England, but it was for the whole world, because it led to the creation of the British Empire, and it led to the massive increase in the power of the mercantile classes, the merchants in the City of London, and places like here in Bristol. So it's quite, I suppose, understandable when all this was happening that there was an incredible ferment.
Yes, and it was a time of intense end-time speculation and conversation.
In amongst the counterculture of the time.
Oh, absolutely. Go onto the streets of London or Bristol, any major city, and you'd find pamphlets telling you this and pamphlets telling you that, because obviously the royal control, the royal censorship had broken down in the run-up to the Civil War and during the Civil War. So everybody that can, who will, is producing a pamphlet about something or another. Extraordinary stuff. And within that, you'll find a huge amount of end-time speculation. A whole group, for example, called the Fifth Monarchy Men, who believe that the Fourth Monarchy, back to Daniel 7 again, has come to its completion. They clearly were wrong. The Little Horn has been destroyed. That is Charles the First, and they are now going to become the people that usher in Christ's kingdom. They are the Fifth Monarchy Men, the Fifth Monarchy being Christ's millennial kingdom. Now, clearly they were sincere. They led revolts. They were very strong in the army, for example, in the New Model Army. We know, for example, that Colonel Rainsborough, who was present at the Siege of Bristol, was very sympathetic towards the Fifth Monarchists, for example. So there's a local West Country connection there. He was actually at the Siege of Bristol. But clearly, they were wrong. Cromwell speaks to the Bare Bones Parliament, I think it's 1653, and he says, you are as much of the forming of God as anybody. You stand at the edge of promises and prophecies. And he genuinely thought that he was about to implement something that was kind of somehow going to kickstart this end times rule. He didn't know how. Cromwell was always rather vague about it, but he kind of believed it. tragically, he was wrong. So much so that when some were led to the scaffold after 1660 and Reformation, I think it was Major General Harrison, who was a Fifth Monarchy man, he's in the cart being led to be hanged, drawn and quartered. And people from the crowd yell to him, "Where now? Where now is your good old cause?" And others said of him, "The Lord hath spat in his face." Now, this is really hard stuff to say. But of course, what they remember was 10 years before that, people like Major Harrison had been telling them absolutely confidently that he was the person who was interpreting scripture rightly. And in 1660, as they saw him go off to be hanged, drawn and quartered, they reminded of him of this in a not very gracious manner.
No. Also, the mayor of Bristol, he professes all sorts of ideas about God. He's certainly associated himself with Hope Chapel, which I used to go to years ago, up in Hotwells. And so I thought we'd have a listen to Marvin Rees now. It's a little clip from him talking about God.
I mean, my relationship with the church in Bristol is a long one and comes with an offer and an ask. I grew up in Bristol. You know, I would say the church was a pivotal intervention in my life, gave me a sense of purpose, belonging, eternity, hope, that fueled me through the challenges I faced, you know, as a child. And then I joined Tier Fund straight out of university after studying the politics of Black America as a master's. And I was fully immersed in the role of the church in political outcomes. I said to the church this, right? It's no point turning up to God and praying and asking for miracles when the answers are in our hands. God said, you know, what happens when we face God one day? We say, why didn't this bad thing happen when it was a result of political policy? God says, well, I gave you a massive organization, you know, I gave you brains, and I gave you a reasonably functioning democracy. If you chose not to line up all those things to get better social outcomes, then, you know, why are you coming to me asking for a miracle? The miracle is the church getting organized, right? Yeah. And shaping for good social policy.
Well, what do you make of that, Martin?
I have some sympathy for that, on the basis that I think, you know, within the end times context, that we should put less time into speculation and more time into building the kingdom of God on earth here. And I think our challenge as Christians, I'm Christian, I think our challenge as Christians is to work for justice, equality, fairness, peace on earth. We, you know, we may not succeed, we may fail, we fall down, we make mistakes, we get up again. I think we need to put our energy as Christians into building the kingdom of God in the here and now, and we'll let God decide when the end times are coming. And that's why I both believe in the end times, but think, put your energies, guys and gals, into now for God, because at the end of the day, he might come today, he might come tomorrow, might come in 100 years time. You might die today, tomorrow. But the end of the point is, I want to know that whenever he comes, he'll find me about his business.
What do you think of this whole business about the politics and the church? Do they mix? Because, I mean, no one would stop anybody who's in politics having faith, obviously. But, you know, he's saying there, he's basically talking, Marvin Rees there, about bargaining with the local church, saying, you know, I want you to do this and that.
I mean, I think it's right and proper for Christians to be involved in politics, as indeed of any faith. I think people of faith and non-faith need to be engaged in the political decisions of their time. I mean, politics are about people, they're about community. We should have an interest in that. But the one thing that I would challenge my fellow believers about is that I think as a Christian, if you get involved in politics, you're going to have to recognise the fact that there's going to come a time when you are going to fall out with everybody at some point, not all the time. You know, there'll be a point where you'll say to one group, absolutely right on, I think that's appropriate, I'll back you. And then they'll do something, you'll say, yeah, wait a minute, but not there. And I think the danger is when Christians get drawn into party politics to the extent that they have to back their party against their principles and their faith. So I would say to believers, get involved in politics, get involved in decision making, but never ever see that as being your... Ultimately, you're about building the kingdom of God, and there'll be things you agree with and things you disagree with, and you're going to fall out with people within the political realms eventually
whichever group you join, not permanently, hopefully, because you cannot ever get into the my party right or wrong situation. You are inevitably going to be saying something like, I'm very happy with that, but I'm not at all happy with that. And that doesn't go well within the political system because people want you to sign up to the whole nine yards. And a simple issue is the only whole nine yards that believers sign up to is their faith. So get involved, be radical. Don't be rude, you know, be gracious in your assertiveness, but recognise the fact that eventually you are going to disagree with the system at some point or another, and then tomorrow you might agree with it, because actually it's quite difficult to have a prophetic voice, because you cannot just sign up to the whole system.
Well, that's right. There's so much horse trading involved in politics. Yeah. And I mean, I think all politicians, is the quicker that they lose their principles seems to be they seem to rise to the top in politics, the quicker they do lose their principles. But look, I just want to take a step back from all of this, really, looking at the context of where we are now after the Second World War, because I know that the Prime Minister at the time of Dunkirk, Winston Churchill, did a speech which I found quite interesting. I mean, he talks there about the future of Christian civilization, but he also mentions the idea of perverted science, and the idea that, of course, that the Nazis were using science in all sorts of peculiar ways, particularly through this whole concept of eugenics, which previously actually had been quite popular in Britain and in the United States.
Indeed,
so I just think we have a listen. It's only a short speech, about a minute and a half. You know, this, I think, sounds in a discussion about how strong the church is, or Christianity is, the church really, I suppose, being God's people rather than any kind of institution or building, in comparison to the idea of Christianity standing up to Hitler back in 1940. This was actually recorded on the 18th of June.
The Battle of France is over. The Battle of Britain is about to begin. Upon this battle depends the survival of Christian civilization. Upon it depends our own British life and the long continuity of our institutions and our empire. The whole fury and might of the enemy must very soon be turned on us. Hitler knows that he will have to break us in this island or lose the war. If we can stand up to him, all Europe may be free, and the life of the world may move forward into broad, sunlit uplands. But if we fail, then the whole world, including the United States, including all that we have known and cared for, will sink into the abyss of a new dark age, made more sinister and perhaps more protracted by the lights of perverted science. Let us, therefore, brace ourselves to our duties and so bear ourselves that if the British Commonwealth lasts for 1,000 years, men will still say, this was their finest hour.
So that's Prime Minister Winston Churchill speaking on the 18th of June 1940, just at the point of the evacuation of the troops from Dunkirk back to Britain. An interesting way he's pitching that, though, Martin. I think it's pretty clear. This is a battle of good and evil.
Yeah, exactly. And I think it's fair enough for the church to make a stand against things that are clearly as evil as Nazism. But Second World War gives an interesting example in the person of George Bell, Bishop of Chichester. So George Bell, Bishop of Chichester, Christian, obviously, opposes the Nazis, opposes Nazism, you know, works with refugees, fine, no problem whatsoever. Then he challenges indiscriminate area bombing of German cities. His position basically being that, I must put words in his mouth, but effectively, I think this is just, I think it's right, I think we ought to take action, but actually, I think we also must behave in a morally acceptable way as well,
And I don't think it's right to indiscriminately area bomb German cities and kill civilians. And at this point, Churchill is incandescent about him, because obviously the expectation from the top is that the church will just stand in its national support of the government in its war against the Germans. But what Bell does is, effectively, Bell says, yeah, as a church, we do stand firm against Nazism. But actually, when you do something wrong, and I think this is wrong, OK, we can debate about that. But Bell says, I think this is wrong. I'm going to say something about it. And he exemplifies the prophetic challenge and difficulty of being a Christian in a fallen world, because he doesn't just sign up for the national program. He says, I sign up for it until I think it's wrong. And when I think it's wrong, I will say so. And that does not go down at all well. But that I in the DNA of Christians engaging with politics.
Yeah, fascinating. And also, of course, we're now in the situation where you've got, well, hundreds and thousands of nuclear weapons, which the temptation for the military of any enemy is to just indiscriminately drop those on cities, which could be even worse. So we're actually in much more of a kind of Bell situation today than we were then, even. Potentially,
we certainly are, and that was why, as a young man, you know, I was involved in the campaign for nuclear disarmament. Because whilst I understood the arguments of mutually assured destruction and that ultimately, you know, we need everybody to reduce their nuclear weapons, and I know it's difficult, I felt it was a kind of weapon that I just could not, be complacent with or comfortable with, because it is impossible to use it in a discriminating way. Now, I know that raises a million and one questions, and I've not got the answers to that, but I think we have to engage with these answers and not just simply adopt what you might call, you know, narrow patriotic in inverted commas or narrow national interest, because there are big moral issues out there, and some of them have just got bigger since the Second World War, not smaller.
Yeah, definitely. Well, anyway, bringing this a bit more up to today, I was interested to see, I mean, from the Second World War idea of good and evil, Prince Charles, who certainly stands to be potentially head of state in the future, comparing the Russians and Putin particularly to Adolf Hitler. So let's have a little listen to a report about that now.
He was in Essex to confer city status on Southend, granted by the Queen after the killing of its MP, Sir David Amis, last year. The killing, he said, was an attack on democracy. But the prince then turned to President Putin's invasion.
We are seeing those same values under attack today in Ukraine in the most unconscionable way. In the stand we take here, we are in solidarity with all those who are resisting brutal aggression.
Prince Charles met Vladimir Putin on a state visit to Britain in 2003, then just a relatively new president of Russia. But he is a politician, it seems, the heir to the throne has never taken to. In 2014, on a trip to Canada, shortly after Putin invaded Crimea, the prince apparently said, "And now Putin is doing just about the same as Hitler." It made sensational headlines at the time, but looks much less sensational after the events of the past week.
Now, this is a bit awkward, Martin, isn't it, when you start to get heads of state making these kinds of statements, as particularly, I think most people, you know, would think, well, we don't really mind if it's an elected president of something saying this, but if when it's a monarchy, this is starting to create all sorts of problems for the diplomats, etc.
Yeah, it's really, really difficult, this one, isn't it? Because lots of people, you know, will have heard what Prince Charles said and think, okay, I agree with that. I mean, not everybody will, but a lot of people will have. But what one of the great strengths of the Queen over the years of her reign is she has been very, very careful not to make the kind of statements which she thinks are best left to elected politicians.
No, they're very different, these two, and it does make you wonder about, you know, the future of the church once the Queen, bless her, dies.
It is a real challenge, this one, because sometimes you think, oh, I wish the Queen would really say what she thinks. But actually, I think not saying what she thinks in many ways has been one of the powerful tools of the monarchy under Queen Elizabeth. And I think there is a danger that once the unelected monarchy gets involved in making very clear and ambiguous political statements, some of them you'll agree with, But in some of them you won't agree with. And that's the danger. So I would just, while I'm sympathetic to what Charles is saying, you know, I think what's going on in Ukraine is appalling. Having made a study of the Soviet secret police and Lieutenant Colonel KGB ex Vladimir Putin, I think he is a brutal, cynical and dangerous man. On the other hand, I think this is one best left to the elected politicians to deal with.
Yeah, I suppose, and the journalists too.
Yeah, absolutely.
Hopefully, if we're allowed any freedom of speech.
Yeah, we've got to think about our own role.
Because we've got this thing called the Online Safety Bill coming along, which we'll be talking about next week, which could be limiting the ability of journalists actually, you know, making certain statements, crimes that journalists make. Obviously, you know, it's very difficult to talk about anything to do with Christianity without seeing a kind of vision of Julian Assange nailed to the cross as someone who's a fearless investigative journalist being basically hung up as it's almost as if he's becoming a martyr. But anyway, look, a couple of final clips. This one is about, you know, this has certainly come a long, long way since the Second World War. Is this a Christian civilization that allows this sort of thing to go on?
It's just a few drops, but yes, we do consume each other's blood on occasion for ritual purposes only. It is used for a reason, and it is controlled, where it's like, let's shed a few drops of blood and each drink it. He's much more haphazard and hectic and chaotic, where he's willing to just like cut his chest open with broken glass and be like, take my soul, let me bleed on you. It doesn't not happen, let me tell you. Maybe not exactly like that, but a version of that has happened many times.
So that's Megan Fox there. Sorry to spring that one on you, Martin. Drinking blood over in the States openly.
What was that? What was that all about? What's her backstory? What's that all about?
Well, she's there as some sort of actress or musician on TV over there. Yes, confessing that her and her partner do drink each other's blood, and they actually think it's quite cool. And what's the problem?
I think it's quite weird, and I think it is a problem. On the other hand, I suppose if they're two consenting adults, I can't actually stop them from having a little nip of each other's blood. But personally, my personal view is it's weird, and don't do it at home.
Well, I mean, this is, I suppose, an example of the change in culture. And another thing is, after the Second World War, the Witchcraft Acts were repealed. We were talking about that in the first part of this show, which was the Reformation, where suddenly it was down to the British Crown and the British Church to deal with witchcraft, which previously it had been the Vatican. But I noticed this week, another time, Nicola Sturgeon, the First Minister of Scotland, saying that the witches in particularly in North Berwick and other witches in Scotland that were tried under James VI, I think, of Scotland and James I of England, that they must be pardoned. Well, I think this is a little bit strange, because these were jury trials at the time, and the idea that somebody in the past can then go back and undo a jury trial, well, maybe she's got more evidence, and if so, I think we should hear it. But anyway, this was this being discussed on GB News this week.
Like, this is the kind of stuff that makes people feel like we're living in a clown world, right? You know, the idea now that I've got the leader of a country, well, the pound shop leader of a country, in the shape of Nicola Sturgeon, right, saying that she's pardoning witches, she's apologising to people who died 300 years ago. You've got another MP there who's saying this is the biggest issue of the day. I tell you what, I'm absolutely certain, Rebecca, that those people in her constituency who can't afford food, whose kids have got a terrible education under Queen Nick, the NHS is absolutely knackered up there, alcohol and drug dependency. I tell you what, Rebecca, I bet they're so glad that she's pardoned witches.
Yeah. Exactly that. That's why I say that I am struggling to care. You know, history and all the rest of it, yes, we should care in some respects. But right now, in this day and age, no, I don't think this is what we should be doing and what we should be focusing our time on. But it's Nicola Sturgeon, does what she wants.
I completely agree that, you know, there are pressing issues that need to be looked at. But, you know, we're talking about righting historic wrongs so that we can lead by example. And so, for example, you know, that witchcraft is still something that is illegal in many countries today. So I think what the idea is that we are leading by example by being a forward-thinking country. And, you know, for personal reasons, I think that there's it's such a witchcraft and witches, it's such a misunderstood concept today. You know, we don't, I mean, I've kind of got the black lace on tonight just for a bit of fun, but generally we are normal, everyday people. Mm.
So this whole issue of witchcraft today, Scotland is mulling pardoning thousands convicted of witchcraft long after they're dead. A Scottish lawmaker has launched a bid to posthumously pardon thousands of people, mostly women, who were convicted of witchcraft centuries ago, Martin.
I think there's a big difference for a start between people who practice witchcraft today, or Wicca or Witcher, as sometimes called, and the people who were executed for witchcraft in the past. The vast majority of people who were executed between, let's say, 1450 and 1750, it went on longer in Scotland than in England, for witchcraft, were not involved in any kind of satanic rites. They were mostly old, poor, mostly women, and they were scapegoated for the problems of their society. So I think to see them as actually being members of an alternative religion to the Christianity of their time is actually an error.
I'm just trying to be fair to the, in the Elizabethan period. I was saying in the first bit that there was an understanding that there were witch hunts, as we still call them when it comes to people like Jeremy Corbyn and people like that. Witch hunts after witches in those days, where people were being just accused of doing X, Y, and Z sort of rituals with the devil, and this was a very, very dodgy, and so they shouldn't be. And under Elizabeth, they said you actually have to prove in court that the person has actually proved harm to somebody before you can have a conviction, which seems to me to make a lot more sense. And then that was then overturned later by James. So, you know, there are all sorts of changes in the way this was. But anyway, so what do you make of this whole sort of thing of modern witchcraft and this idea of pardoning people from hundreds of years ago?
Well, as I said, firstly, I think historic witchcraft is different to modern witchcraft. I don't think these historic people who were burned as witches were for a moment Satanists. I don't think they were. I think most of them were scapegoated for socioeconomic problems of their time. I generally think that. On the other hand, I don't think that we can actually effectively achieve anything by pardoning, although I do think appalling miscarriages of justice took place, to be frank.
When they still are.
Absolutely so. With regard to the whole topic in its broader sense, I don't think it's a matter for the courts. I think it's a matter of people's personal choice. And although some people do things that I'm appalled by and shocked by and totally disagree with, I think my response is prayer and assertive discussion with them as to why I think it's wrong, not using the force of law. And so I would say that this is an area where law should not be applied to enforce conformity to a particular religious faith, that we need to simply persuade people they're wrong, if we think they're wrong, not to use the force of law behind us. For the same reason, I would not have blasphemy laws. I mean, I know, you know, some people would like them to be returned. I would say no. I think at the end of the day, God's big enough to defend himself, and I will make my case as to why I think that's wrong and offensive, and it upsets me and upsets people. But I don't want policemen going around sort of knocking down doors and picking people up because they are blaspheming against the faith that I have. I'll be offended by what they say. I'll be upset by what they say. I'll tell them that, I hope graciously, assertively. But I don't want the courts to do that. I think there are some things that do not belong in the realm of the court.
So what you're saying, I suppose, is that there's not much point in having these bishops in the House of Lords, that this isn't really a Christian country anymore.
Ultimately, I think that we need to completely review the House of Lords. And in fact, there may well be a role for bishops in it at some point, as there may well be a role for people from all sorts of faith communities and all sorts of cultural representations. I think personally, this is not the official Church of England position. I think that the entire political system needs review, and the Church of England, and the House of Lords needs total review, to be honest about this. I don't think you can describe Britain as a Christian country today. Does that panic me? No, because the early Christian church was in a community where they were a tiny radical minority, where most people were not believers. They didn't run scared. They didn't try to use the force of the state to make others. They simply got out there living radical lifestyles and preaching the gospel. It was when they had coercive power, after basically the Edict of Milan and the beginning of the 4th century, that things went badly wrong. I don't want coercive power behind my faith.
Also, Tim Cohen, over in the States, I've interviewed a couple of times. He's brought out a book called The Antichrist and a Cup of Tea, where he believes he's identified the Antichrist as Prince Charles. What do you make of that?
Yeah, I'm not quite persuaded by that one. I mean, basically, why? What's Prince Charles done to rattle his cage?
Well, he comes up with all sorts of what he says are biblical references, saying that Charles most definitely is. But anyway, I mean, you know, this is, I suppose, grist to them. I'm kind of winding you up in a way here, Martin, really, by saying, you know, actually, there are people publishing stuff now which is completely flying in the face of the argument you're trying to make in this excellent article, The Day of the Lord. Also, just to remind you, Martin's book is called The End Times, comma, again, question mark. Do you want to just wind up, Martin, by telling us a bit about the book?
Yeah, the book basically looks at the roots of the belief in end times in Christianity, within Judaism, and within the New Testament. It then looks at the history of that over 2,000 years, different ideas about it, how it's changed and developed over time, how different concepts have arisen, how people have understood it differently. It comes right up to date and looks at how people are arguing for or against identifying things happening at the moment as the end times. And within it, it's pretty clear from my point of view that whilst I believe in the end times, I think we should leave it to God and get on with living good lives here and now. Leave the end times to God, get on with building the kingdom of God is my basic premise.
Yeah, after all, we are supposed to be his eyes, his ears, his in his hands and his feet. Absolutely. Right now. Anyway, so where is anywhere that people can follow you on social media, etc., Martin?
Yeah, they can find me. I'm basically I'm at Martin Historian on Twitter. They can find my books on Amazon or any online or indeed terrestrial bricks and mortar bookshop can get hold of them as well. So basically, Martin Whittock, Martin with a Y, Whittock. Find my books online or in bricks and mortar bookshops, and also I'm on Twitter as well.
God bless you, Martin Whittock, and thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me. Great to have this very engaging conversation.
It's time to wind up now, and we'll be doing so in just a second. Time to sign off. Thanks to our guest, Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers, and author of End Times Again, Martin Whittock, you just heard there. Also sound engineer Dave Bazanko. Download our MP3s to listen in the car or anywhere you like. Please send me interviews and story tips via Not the BCFM Politics show page. We should have a little bit more time for them next week, having had only about an hour to talk through the news this week. And you also find the podcast, full-length interviews, story links, comment page, our email addresses at thisweekoneword.org.uk, the show page. The live stream is now, as of now, please bookmark it. It's at live stream is at talkradio.org.uk. And this show is repeated at 11 on Fridays and 11 and 5 all week on the stream. This is the talkradio.org.uk stream, the live stream. And we've been streaming live today from the People's Republic of Stokescroft in Bristol and at radioqUK.com in Camberley, Surrey. Censorship and military disinformation is sadly the norm in Britain today, thanks to the collaborators who own the transmitters and the printing presses. So if you can restream us live or rebroadcast us, just let me know and we'll credit you here. Here's wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable Glastonbury-free weekend. Yes, they really have sold out about as much as a festival can sell out down there. I remember some brilliant days in the 1980s, but certainly the counterculture is not counter. It's been assimilated by the Borg. Do please join us for Not the BCFM Politics Show, the live stream at 5 o'clock next Friday. God bless. And don't let the banksters get you down.
I'm gonna lay down my sword and shield
down by the riverside. Down by the riverside.
Yeah.
Down by the riverside.
I'm gonna lay down my sword and shield
down by the riverside.
I'm gonna study.
Study war no more. War no more.
I ain't gonna study war no more. I'm gonna study war no more. I ain't gonna study.
Down by the riverside.
Yeah.
Down by the riverside.
riverside. I'm gonna lay down my heavy load
down by the riverside.
Gonna study one
more, or more, more, or more.
I ain't gonna study one more. Ain't gonna study one more. I'm gonna lay down my heavy load
down by the riverside. Gonna study
no
more, no more,
no more.
Then I looked over Jordan and what did I see? Coming for to carry me home. There was a band of angels a-coming after me, coming for to carry me home. Swing low,
swing low,
sweet chariot, coming for to carry me home. Swing low, sweet chariot, coming for to carry me home. Well, I'm sometimes up and I'm sometimes down, coming for to carry me home. But I know my soul is heavenly bound, coming for to carry me home. Swing low,
swing low,
sweet chariot, coming for to carry me home. Swing low, sweet chariot, coming for to carry me home. Well, now if you get there before I do, coming for to carry me home, tell all my friends that I'm a-coming too, coming for to carry me home. Swing low,
swing low,
sweet chariot, coming for to carry me home. Swing low, sweet chariot, coming for to carry me home. Well, now they're coming for to carry me home.